Hey everybody, and welcome to Radio Free Nintendo. I'm your host, Jonathan Metz, and with me as always, Guillaume Viet.
Now 20% less cynical.
James Jones.
Just 20. That's not even measurable.
And John Lindemann.
Got my Whopper in hand, and I'm ready to go.
Put the Whopper down, John!
Never.
Yes, so it's time for our first episode post E3 2012. As you know, Guillaume and I were at the show, John and James covering it from home. Thought the home team really killed it this year, as always, actually. Always do a fantastic job. And I know that I still have some things to write because I was at Bonnaroo right after E3 and I haven't really had internet for very much time. Certainly haven't been playing games very much since the end of E3. But I know these guys have. So the format of this episode is going to be, we'll start out with new business, maybe talk about a couple things that, those of us who were at E3 might talk about some stuff we didn't get a chance to talk about last week. These other guys, you know, have been playing stuff at home. And then, in the second part of the show, we're kind of save our wrap up, our sort of evaluation of how the show went down and everything. We'll save that because we got tons of emails about that kind of thing. And, so we're going to answer a bunch of listener mail in the second segment. A lot of it is E3 focused, as you might expect. And we'll get into some nitty gritty stuff. That's for sure. But first up is new business, and James is going to lead it off for us.
Yep. So the first game I'm going to talk about is what I spoke about 2 weeks ago, which is Disaster Day of Crisis, which I have now completed, and I am all the worse for having done so. But the reason I want to talk about it more than anything is that near the end of the game, you are fighting the game's boss, and he says a nice callback from previous discussions of games on RFN when he announces, as an imperative, that you should eat his ballistics.
Really? Nice.
At which point, I seriously considered stopping playing Disaster Day of Crisis. But I recognized I was near the end because I was now fighting on a car carrier going out to sea during a hurricane with an armed nuclear device in the deck.
That's completely plausible.
At which point I concluded, shit, this must be the end. Also, the dude I was fighting had a mech on a ship.
Of course, that's the tip-off right there.
Yeah, this might be the end day here.
You know, as much as we can laugh at Disaster, I think like a trailer of like a sequel to Disaster would have really spiced up Nintendo's E3.
Oh god, I mean, it would have been absurdist. People would have just been sitting there just with their head in their hands going, "What is going on?"
it definitely would have been that surprise.
Yeah, yes.
That was lacking.
Oh my god. But I want to talk about a couple things about the game is kind of in its totality. In that, if you play the game to expect to enjoy really solid gameplay, or even just solid gameplay, it's obviously disappointing. Gameplay ranges from not good to actually being manageably acceptable. Like, that's pretty much the high arc, is that this is acceptable gameplay. But what, for me, I found the game to be is, if you're just looking for an experience, just something to sit there and watch and go, holy fuck.
An experience. Yeah, I can't think of the last time I walked into GameStop and I was like,
give me an experience. Yeah. It's, the problem though, what makes it not worth the ride to me is that there are moments in the game where the gameplay is just so not right that it blocks your ability to continue to experience what it's peddling. A great example, I was actually stuck here when we were talking last week, or 2 weeks ago, and I got through it finally. But there's a scene where you're driving away from a tsunami in a sedan on a bridge that's collapsing. And the problem is that the camera is pointed basically in the entirely opposite direction of where you're – it's pointed at the front of your car so you can see the tsunami behind you. But that also means you can't see the shit on the road in front of you.
It's brilliantly designed right there.
So crap like that is what really ruins the game. I mean, like, if that kind of stuff wasn't – and there's, you know, 5-6 times in the 7-hour game where that happens. And if that stuff wasn't there, it would be all about fire tornadoes ravaging a park or rescuing a little girl from a bear. If the really bad sticking points weren't there, and most of them happen when you're driving, it would be a game I would recommend, if only for the sheer what-the-fuck value of it. But they are there.
Let's move on. We've talked way too much about Disaster over the past few months.
So, and because I am on all kinds of import kicks recently, I now have, as a gift, a copy of Pandora's Tower. So like I said, I was given this as a gift. I really hadn't planned on importing this one. Of the three games... Well, four, because if you want to count Disaster. Of the four games that never made it out of Europe that really should have, real classics of the Wii library, this was the one that I was least attached to as a concept. For those who have sort of forgotten what this game is about, the basic premise is you're a dude whose girl has come down with a curse, and this curse is turning her into a beast. And the only way to reverse the curse is to kill beasts that are in these towers and then feed her the flesh of these monsters, and that reverses the curse. And to get rid of the curse forever, you have to feed her the flesh of these 13 boss monsters. The master beasts, yes. You accomplish this by A, beating the shit out of things with your sword, and B, ripping flesh off of them with the chain you control. It's actually a relatively gruesome process, and then you get to watch a cutscene of her taking bites out of these things' hearts. Now, this wasn't traumatic enough for you already that your girlfriend who's turning into a demon is taking bites of the hearts of the still beating hearts of monsters. She also is a vegetarian. Not just like slightly vegetarian. She is in a religion whose entire culture is entirely predicated on veganism. So every time she eats one of these, you get this long moralistic imperative about how this is awful and she doesn't want to do it. And then ultimately you watch her cry as she eats these things. This game is messed the fuck up. Like, the first time it happens, you're like, this is awful. Oh my god. And then like the fifth time, you're like, just eat the fucking thing. God. Don't put me through this anymore.
So is it fun?
You spend most of the time going through these dungeons. There's some light puzzle solving. There's some light platforming. You know, there's switches. It's kind of like a more linear Zelda in that way. The combats, it's third person. A lot of fixed-ish cameras that kind of run on a rail. You beat enemies up with a sword, or you can use this chain that you control with the pointer to do all kinds of combo attacks on them. You know, you can grab somebody with the chain and then yank the life out of them and then slam them to the ground. Combat itself, I kind of compare it to Rygar, the PS2 game.
You know, I was just thinking about Rygar as you sort of described this.
That's the only game that I can really think of that I'm like, yeah, there's a game that kind of like this.
I mean, Rygar is probably, if you go back to it now, not a very impressive game.
No.
But at the time, this was, you know, it was kind of a contemporary of Devil May Cry, like the original Devil May Cry. It was way before God of War. And at the time, it was a pretty cool game.
So the combat itself is somewhat fluid, but where the game actually shines okay is you have to feed her meat periodically or she will turn into a demon. So a lot of times there's sort of this like run back to where she's camped out with some kind of meat because you haven't made it to the master yet, and like see this really horribly deformed person you give meat, and it's really unsettling. But the real win in the game is when you get to the bosses, which are usually at the top of these towers, that you have to basically bust these chains off their door throughout the level in order to get in. These are more puzzle-solvey bosses. They're really big. They've got specific weaknesses that you can get to, but a lot of times you have to sort of manage not being killed by their defense mechanisms and getting into position to get to them. There was one where this is basically the representation of the Earth God, and it's able to just summon rocks that basically obstruct your ability to get to it. So you have to use its attacks to pound the rocks out of the way, and then try to get to its weak point, hit it with the chain, and pull it, and then know when to release before he can counterattack you. It's actually really a very stressful experience. These are big bosses that take a lot of effort to bring down, and actually fighting them can be relatively rewarding, assuming you have healing items, which the game will either give to you in a kind of a feast or famine situation, and you've got enough time left on the girl before she turns into a full demon. So my last boss, I think it was like boss 5, I was perilously close, but I didn't want to go all the way down the tower, all the way back up, in order to prevent her from turning into a demon. So I was just trying to gun it as fast as I could.
This sounds like Majora's Mask.
A little bit.
This time management and the stress of of not making it out of the dungeon before something really bad happens.
Yeah, I mean, that's actually a pretty good comparison, because you spend a lot of time just kind of watching that gauge going, man, do I have enough time to get to the top of the tower? Maybe I should go back. It was probably the third tower I had to actually go back for the first time, and it's an incredibly obnoxious, not like in a bad way, it's just like, oh, I don't want to do that, but I don't have a choice in the matter. And you sort of schlep back to the tower that she's in, you know, you provide her with whatever meat you've got, you go interact with this really creepy old woman who's guiding you along this path to undoing this curse, who the game has pretty clearly set up the twist of the plot with her. You sell items, you get new healing items, you go back to the tower and you proceed on again. And it's all just a matter of saying, okay, this time I'm going to make it to the top of that tower. And, you know, a lot of the stuff that you've cleared before, you can kind of short circuit if you've played it well. But still, there's always this kind of like mode of, I need to get there quicker. I need to get there quicker. I need to have enough time to beat the boss. I need to figure out how the boss is beaten. So it's kind of this cycle of gradual improvement as you play the game. The game also throws in the dating sim mode to improve the power of your chain, because you've soul linked with this girl in this chain. So there's that.
wait, don't skip over the dating sim.
Yeah.
So you have to play out a dating sim with this girl who is part demon.
She's normally human, but as the gauge goes down, she becomes increasingly demonic looking.
But so can you play the dating game with her as she is like almost become a demon?
So the dating game, really, it's somewhat simplistic. You can get gifts for her. You either find them around, like I found a lantern that she adored. You give them to her, you know, she talks about how great they are, she says something specific about them, a little video sequence of you, her, and the item play, and then, you know, your relationship with her improves slightly. So yeah, I mean, combat, I actually enjoy the combat system to an extent. You know, you can string multiple enemies together with the chain and tie them to each other just to screw with them. To a certain you aim with the pointer, so to a certain extent you can pick where the chain hits. So, like, there are some enemies where they'll have a sword, and if you aim with the chain just right, you could rip the sword from their hands, and now they're unarmed.
I always thought there'd be a Castlevania game for Wii that did that, but it
never happened.
It never came.
There are some enemies you can tie their legs together so they fall down, and then you pull the chain to do damage to them. The combat itself is evolved enough that you could do interesting things with it. It's fluid enough that it works, and most of it you can avoid to an extent. And the game rewards you coming back to the different towers by having these really valuable items that you can get to later once you've got upgrades. So there is a bit of Zelda in here. There's some of the Rygar. There is some Majora's Mask, actually, that you mentioned it. And there's some of this weird, dark, macabre shit that just makes the whole thing feel somewhat unsettling. I'm enjoying it. I'll probably wrap it up this week and have final thoughts on it after that.
Cool. Well, it's one to keep on our radar. We didn't hear anything about it at E3, but you know, maybe at some point after the last story is released, we might still have a chance here in America to North America, I should say, to get Pandora's Tower. And if not, well,
you already jailbroke your Wii.
Yeah. So, John, what did you want to talk about this week?
This week we got the news that apparently Call of Duty Black Ops 2 will be coming to Wii U.
Which, by the way, last week at Activision's press area, where I was going to see a couple of games back there, I talked to their PR people and I was like, you know, they didn't even like offer to take me into Call of Duty. I basically had to insist because I wanted to see it. I assumed that it would be announced at some point for, you know, 3DS or Wii U or whatever. But I said, you know, aren't you guys showing this, you know, isn't this going to be on Wii or Wii U or something? And they're like, I don't know, we haven't announced anything. And I'm like, come on. I'm sure they just wanted to get separate media coverage for it, except I'm not sure that anyone outside of our site really cares.
Not really.
People might care, but I don't think anyone's really surprised. I mean,
no,
I just don't...
it's fucking Call of Duty. I mean,
well, the thing is, right? You have to understand. I think that they may actually be under a gag order from Nintendo as well. Nintendo may not want anything going out about games without their say-so.
Yeah, Nintendo wouldn't want to appear successful amongst the third parties. Like, look like they have support.
Now, hey, Nintendo's weird like that. I mean, you know, not everything they do makes sense.
But at E3, I mean, the chains were broken after last Tuesday. I mean, everything was getting announced all at once. Surely Nintendo would want to make sure people knew that the inevitably most successful game of 2012 will be arriving on their brand new system and will have some kind of unique features that we don't know anything about yet. And I'm sure it will be online, you know, so it's probably going to be one of the big flagship online titles for Wii U.
Right.
I don't understand.
Yeah, I mean, I would chalk it up to something like they probably don't have a launch time frame nailed down, and they don't want to really talk about it until that time, right? So I would think that it's probably not going to be because Nintendo was so key about this is what we're going to release in the launch window. Maybe it's not going to be out in that launch window, and Nintendo didn't want to announce that game and then say, oh, well, it's not in the launch window, sorry.
But even if it weren't in the launch window, though, I mean, that wouldn't stop Activision from talking about it. I mean, there were games talked about for Wii U that aren't going to be in the launch window. Nintendo didn't talk about them, but they were talked about. I mean, it'd be dumb if it's not in the launch window because the Wii U is basically Xbox 360 kit. It's more powerful, but I mean, it's a pretty transparent jump from one to the other, or it should be.
John, would you? I mean, you know, I know you've played some Call of Duty. I have too. Would you be interested in getting this game for Wii U?
Yeah, I mean, it would definitely be tempting. I mean, the thing that I would like to see what they do is, you know, because they have their Elite service, right? Now, you know, it's $50. That's a hefty price. But the thing is, I mean, price aside, the actual service itself could actually be really, really cool on the Wii gamepad. I mean, as it stands now, I mean, for the other consoles, you know, if you want to check out how you're doing or, you know, check out your stats and everything, you have to go on the web or on 360. It's kind of cumbersome because, you know, you have to load it completely. You have to exit out of the game and then load up another separate app to look at all that stuff, right? Oh, yeah. Yep.
What, you're saying that's not useful?
It's useful, but it's cumbersome.
Yeah, it should be. I mean, this should be integrated into the game if you're playing Call of Duty.
Seriously.
I mean, I can see having a channel that you could boot up even if you don't have the disc in. But you certainly should be able to access the same content within the game, too.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, that's the thing. It's not... I mean, you have to exit out of the game and launch the separate app to do it. I mean, that's just the way
sucks.
It is. Yeah, it kind of sucks. But that's where I think the Wii gamepad would be really, really good is the fact that, I mean, there's really nothing that I can see that's on Elite that you would not really be able to put on the gamepad. And the thing is, you could actually see your stuff update in pretty much real time because stuff does update on the web really quickly.
And you're talking about, like, statistics and stuff, right?
Yeah.
I mean, that's kind of the tracking that Elite does, other than...
Yeah.
I mean, Elite is... To me, it's almost like just a season pass to DLC. And then everything else seems like really kind of trivial bonus features beyond that.
You know, they go through each gun, and they'll tell you, like, you know, what works best with it perk-wise and kind of what tweaks you can do. And they, you know, they have, like, you know, this nice video treatment that's, you know, fully, you know, voice with a full voiceover that'll tell you, you know, yeah, if you're fighting with this gun, you should use this perk because of this reason, which actually is helpful. I mean, to have that all collected in one place is very nice. I mean, it does really help you knowing that kind of stuff. But it would be I think it would be amazing to have it sitting there right in front of you. So anytime you wanted to access Elite, you could just, you know, click something on the gamepad and boom, you're right in there. What if you pause the game and Elite came right up on your gamepad? At that point, you could, you know, watch a video. You could, you know, see if your friends are online, maybe set it up to jump into one of their games, check out your stats, see them update as you're playing. You could do a lot of really, really cool stuff with it that you couldn't do on 360 or PS3 and probably won't be able to do on PS4 or the next Xbox either. So it'll be interesting to see what they do with it because they do have, you know, iOS apps and Android apps. I've never used those, so I don't really know exactly what they show on that, but I think they could do a lot more with the Wii gamepad. Yeah, but this is the kind of stuff, though, I mean, that really I don't think Nintendo is actually making enough of a big deal of.
Oh, I agree. I mean, especially if the Wii U version can be the best version, if it has better graphics than the 360 and PS3 versions, which it should, then that alone is a pretty big incentive to get people to jump over. I mean, yes, you will lose the community aspect of being able to play with certain people, you know, that are already on your your Xbox Live friends list or whatever. Mm-hmm. But I think they could get a certain percentage of the audience who are interested in playing basically the best version at any given time.
Yeah.
And if they could actually show that this is demonstrably a better version than you have on the other systems, you know, and you don't have to play with the pointer controls if you don't want to. You can use the Pro controller, or even on the gamepad, you have all the buttons you need right there.
Yep.
And, you know, I feel like they should be able to convince people to even some of the current, you know, pretty hardcore Call of Duty fan base should be able to convince a few of them to jump over, in addition to maybe getting some Nintendo fans who haven't taken a bite on it before.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, I think you'll get people just, you know, taking a flyer on it. Like, hey, I haven't really played any of these games before. Let's give it a try.
So, you know, what's funny to me about this is that Ubisoft already did this for them. If you remember, Johnny, if you remember last year when we were at E3, Ubisoft had that demo of what the Ghost Recon. They basically had what was Call of Duty Elite on the tablet sitting there on her table while she was playing. It was updating all her game stats. It was telling her what her friends were doing. It was giving her hints. Mm-hmm. I mean, it was right there. It's like, Activision, it's right here. Take it. Ubisoft dropped the ball and decided not to make this game anymore. Yeah. Go for it.
Yep. I mean, and the thing is, it would actually even be better than it is on Xbox, because on Xbox, the interface is kind of goofy to, you know, go through with a gamepad. It's really meant for Kinect, just the way it's designed.
Oh God, it's meant for
a mouse or Kinect. You can tell because you can just look at it and it's very swipe friendly. It's right. Very click friendly and swipe friendly. When you're in the middle, you know, looking through all your stats, you have to press start to access the sidebar, and then you click down on your sidebar, and then press start to jump back in. It's just really, it's really wonky. But
you can just do it with your finger and go slide, click.
Yep. So it's very much designed for Kinect. But yeah, it'll be really interesting to see what they do with Black Ops. I mean, it's going to be a huge game. So I think, I mean, it's really great that the platform's getting it. I don't see really any downside to it.
Yeah, my only concern, it's not a downside, it's just a concern, is that Activision half-asses it.
That's exactly, yeah. It'll be interesting to see how much support they actually give it.
But as a publisher/development house, they are a company I could see half-ass it.
You know, I mean, I assuming that Treyarch makes the Wii U version, as they have all the Wii versions of Call of Duty, even the games that they didn't originally make, and Treyarch is the sort of the head studio making Black Ops 2.
Right.
Yep. I feel like they would do a pretty good job with it, because by all accounts, the Wii versions of Call of Duty have been very good.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah, they have.
Better than they have any right to be, because they sell okay, but they don't sell great, you know, but it seems like the people who work on those versions really take a lot of pride in what they do.
Yeah, I always wonder, though, how much they'll actually promote the Nintendo version of the game, because up to this point, it was funny, Johnny, you know, what you were saying, how they wouldn't tell you anything about Wii U. Well, they never said anything about Nintendo consoles up to this point anyway, so that doesn't really surprise me. It's like, oh yeah, by the way, we have something coming out for Wii, Modern Warfare Reflex. Yeah, whatever. We'll just release it. We're not going to promote it at all.
Show no pictures.
You know, they don't promote anything. Yep.
I want to see them just try stuff. I don't care if the game is great. This is their one chance they get to experiment with this kind of gameplay.
Yeah.
You know, if they do stuff that sounds like a terrible idea in the end or after the fact, fine. Okay, that's too bad, but I want to see them try things. This is their chance to do. I mean, there's literally no competition in the space for them right now.
I'll tell you one idea that I'm sure is on their minds if they haven't already started implementing it. I don't know how much you guys know about Black Ops 2 yet. I saw the demo. They were running it on 360 or something at E3. But I was very impressed with this demo, not just because it's flashy and it has good graphics, which you would expect from Call of Duty.
Right.
But I was impressed at the new ideas that they're injecting into a franchise that they, let's be honest, they could be pretty lazy and not give a shit, and this would still sell 10 million copies. So the fact that they're actually trying to push it and they're expanding the scope of the gameplay and they're trying to do new things with it, even if it's unnecessary, I really appreciate that. So one of the things that Treyarch is doing in Black Ops 2 is a new kind of level, and I think they were calling them sandbox levels, but the idea is that instead of this being kind of a point-to-point thing where you're like following a guy or you're just going to where your HUD tells you to go, it's more of this kind of set, you know, square kind of arena, and there's a lot of obstacles in there. There might be enemies coming in from various sides, and you've got something that you have to guard or something that you have to destroy, or you just have to survive. Maybe your people have to survive for a certain amount of time. And so you're running around. You can go anywhere within this environment. You're kind of multitasking. There's got guys all over the place. You have to go and hunt them down. You might be kind of stealthily sneaking around trying to find them. But you've also got these drones that are flying overhead. Some of them are for surveillance. Some of them have machine guns on them. You've got tanks on the ground that you can control. You got little robotic rovers. And so and you're also controlling a dude. And so you're basically jumping around all these different interfaces and trying to manage the battlefield. So you're like, you're this kind of combat architect trying to figure out where is everything? Where do I need to go? Where can I assign resources? It's also got like, you can Rainbow Six style, like send dudes over here, send dudes over here. So you're managing all this and occasionally still running around and shooting people all in this.
Oh, so it's Bui.
I don't know. But, anyway, it's very busy. It's very non Call of Duty looking, you know, really looks like part strategy game, part shooter. I was very surprised to see this. And you think about the kind of stuff that they were doing. You could easily work in the Wii U gamepad into this. I mean, you could have your drone view from overhead, which was, you know, a really cool looking interface, and it marks different targets and you move it around and it can get shot out of the air by the enemies if they see it. So you kind of have to make sure you don't go too low.
I mean, that's right out of the Ghost Recon demo from last year. I mean, that was in there. Yeah.
There's so many obvious implementations of the gamepad that I would really love for them to do a great version. And if you want to figure out how to promote it, here's the thing. If the graphics are better on the Wii U version than on any other version, then Activision is naturally going to want to use the Wii U version when they cut gameplay trailers for TV commercials and, you know, put it out, send it out to the media and that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. So if you can, you know, if the Wii U is powerful enough to really make this version the best one, then it will naturally get showcased. And Nintendo doesn't have to pay extra for that. And they don't even have to really try. It's just, that's the best version. That's the one that the publisher is going to want to show off. And then people will see that and say, oh, that's the one I want.
Yeah, but to get Activision to devote the effort to show the extra content, not just the really cool stuff.
That's where Nintendo does have to be proactive.
Yes. You know?
Okay, well, Guillaume, why don't you go next for new business?
All right. Well, I was going to talk about the games that I've been playing since E3, but you want to know what I did on Thursday when we didn't record a podcast?
Sure.
I had appointments. I was hoping against hope that publishers like Majesco would have something worthwhile for me to see. I ended up watching a demo of Zumba Fitness Core.
Yes! Dinosauring Mama!
That was basically like my Thursday. It was not very exciting. Although I did get, and you did get to play it too, we went to the Disney booth and we saw Epic Mickey for 3DS, The Power of Illusion.
I can't say much because I only played it for about 5 minutes and I was doing an interview at the same time. So it was a little hard for me to focus on the game. So I'm very curious to hear what you thought of it.
Well, I wrote impressions for the site. You can probably get from my impressions that I was really impressed by the graphics. Like the game looks exactly like you want it to look. Like,
yeah, it looks amazing.
It does. It's a high definition 2D platformer, and it looks fantastic on the 3DS screen. And it's exactly the kind of game that I want more of on the handheld. Because like it looked way, way, way better than New Super Mario Brothers 2, that's for sure. And like even though it's 2D and, you know, New Super Mario is polygonal graphics, like it's supposed to be have a bit of 3D to it, the 3D effect was more pronounced in Epic Mickey. And I think the developer said like, oh, we don't want to really like we wanted the effect to be subtle, like we didn't want the effect to bother people.
I don't know that he meant subtle. I think what he was going for there is, they're trying to design the 3D effect so that it doesn't easily break down when you kind of move, you know, if you slightly angle the screen on or off. So I think that has to do with how the layers overlap and how they kind of fuzz in between them, you know, so that they're not showing two extremely drastically different images. So you see a lot of flipping back and forth. The idea is that I think that the transition is smoother and they're just doing some graphical tricks in order to make it harder to lose the effect. I don't know that that necessarily equals being more subtle with the 3D. I think it just means they're trying to keep that in mind.
As a result, it will look more subtle. I mean, because by having the images more closely similar to each other, the effect is less pronounced.
Well, maybe, but like it didn't really show though. Like you were looking at it and it was really like it was nice. It really enhanced that whole aspect of the game.
Sure, but this is one of the situations where having 2D sprite-based graphics can be really advantageous. Not only can you make them much sharper than you can on a polygonal model, but in fact, by layering them in certain ways, you can actually make the layers really pop out, kind of like a picture book. Well, and by layering even a subtle 3D effect on top of that, you could basically magnify how deep things look relative to each other.
It could also just be kind of striking because it is 2D graphics, your mind doesn't really expect any depth. So even a small amount of depth can be kind of surprising to your eyes.
But yeah, like the effect was really impressive, and the game itself, you know, like I really enjoyed it. Like people watching the videos have commented that it looks pretty slow, and it is. And I think if you go back to older Mickey Mouse games, he's always been kind of, you know, like moving slowly through, you know, the various platform games that he's been in.
Well, and Henry Hatsworth and Monster Tale are not very fast paced.
No, and if you think about the era of games they're trying to replicate, they're talking about basically NES era platformers, and those weren't fast. I mean, it really isn't until you have games like Sonic coming out that we start having fast platformers. I mean, a lot of them are really methodical games.
But anyway, like the slowness didn't really bother me at all while I was playing. I was just maybe I was just hypnotized by the graphics, but I really enjoyed what I was playing, and I liked the fact that the like you've got like the draw mechanic in the game, right? Like you've got different things that appear as a silhouette on the bottom screen. They can be objects that are there or that are not in the game in the top screen. If they are on the top screen, then usually like that means that you can erase them, and when they're not, then you can draw them in. And sometimes, you know, like that was required to solve a puzzle and to progress through the game. But at other times, like it seemed pretty optional. Like you would have a cannon shooting like cannonballs like two at a time at you. And you could choose to do traditional platforming and jump over them, like jump between the cannonballs. Or you could just go ahead and erase it from reality and make your own life a whole lot easier. And so, like, this whole, like, switching to draw or to erase something seems to be pretty optional. Like, it's there to help out people who might not be as comfortable with the platforming. And if you don't want to pause the game constantly like that, then, like, it seems like you have the choice not to do it.
Beyond maintaining fluidity, is there any sort of perk for not engaging in basically just eliminating all of your enemies?
I don't think so. Like, not that I've been told that I could notice. What I did see was that there is a benefit to doing well on those phases. Like, if you can manage to erase an object without going over the lines, or if you really follow close, like, if you're really precise when you draw objects in, then Mickey enters some sort of super mode where, like, his attacks last longer. Kind of like when you do really, really well in Henry Hatsworth. And like you're kind of in the super mode, and you can it's much easier to dispatch enemies on the top screen.
I see. Because for me, I remember speaking to development staff for the first Epic Mickey game, and they spoke a lot about how, you know, you encounter hostile situations, and the paint and thinner is more of a moralistic choice. You can take the more difficult route in trying to paint your way out of a situation and be kind of a creator.
I think it's telling that whenever you hear Dream Rift talk about this game, they focus more on the comparison to Castle of Illusion, the Genesis game, than they do Epic Mickey. And I think this game is branded Epic Mickey, and you know it does have the paint and the thinner mechanic, but I think it's less concerned about being consistent with the, you know, the thematic ideas of Epic Mickey than it is with sort of paying tribute to these classic games.
That's kind of what I was trying to get, was how much does it care about its brand?
Yeah. You know, the fact is it looks a lot different than Epic Mickey.
Yeah, it does.
And so I think that already kind of sets you up for the expectation that it could diverge quite a bit from what the console games do, which is fine with me, you know. So I'm looking forward to it as well. I mean, I think, you know, I was asking Peter Ong from Dream Rift in the interview we did about, you know, the possibility of other classic Mickey games being referenced somewhat. And, you know, Neil was asking DuckTales. I was thinking like Magical Quest from Super Nintendo, but these are Capcom games. And
yeah.
I think it would be legally difficult for Disney to really overtly reference these things. I mean, it's possible that they could find ways to do it in a more subtle way that, you know, that they can actually get away with without having to have permission from Capcom.
Sure.
But I don't believe that Disney actually owns those games. You know, I mean, Capcom developed them. I don't think Disney could just willy-nilly start pumping out remakes or ports of those classic Capcom games without their permission. So,
yeah.
I think they're a little bit hamstrung by that aspect of it, but who knows? Maybe they work out some crazy deal. I don't know. Because personally, the other thing is, I've never played Castle of Illusion, and because it's
amazing. It's a great game.
Yeah. I mean, they love it, obviously, I've always heard good things about it. But because it's a licensed game, it's just not available on any kind of digital platform, which would be the easiest way to get a hold of it now. And I'm wondering, because of the really, really strong link here, if they might be able to like include a port of it in with the 3DS game so that you can go back and actually see what was the inspiration for the new one.
Yeah, my first day, I wasn't really, I think I was, I had E3 fatigue. I didn't check out too many things.
Thursday is never productive, ever.
Yeah. I did check out, Marvel Pinball from Zen Studios for a brief time. I did an interview with them. It should be up, at some point on, the YouTube channel. But, it's Marvel Pinball. Like, I've been playing that game for a year. Well, not for a year, but, you know, like a year ago on the PSN. Yeah, like it's coming out soon. It's coming out in the first week of July.
Did they say if it's going to be a totally separate game, like a totally separate app on the eShop?
Yeah, I checked it out. Like I checked the menus and there's no menu options for downloadable content or anything. And I asked the guy and he said like, yeah, like they haven't gotten the kits required to implement DLC until like a few weeks ago. So I asked him like maybe you could do something like WayForward did and basically have people re-download a new version of the game with like extra content and things like that, and he said sure, that's a possibility. not much else that he could answer, but I mean like if WayForward did it and managed to put out a new version of their game and like managed to make the save files compatible, then I, you know, perhaps Zen Studios can do the same thing.
That'd be cool. So, what else did you want to talk about, Guillaume? I mean, we've got all kinds of stuff. We could probably talk for hours about more E3 stuff, but
I don't know how much I can stress how much I want new Super Mario Brothers U. Since I've been playing the demo at E3, like I really, really want that game. And I've actually gone back and played the New Super Mario, this is too long. And NSMB, NSMB Wii, I went back and I did a quick run through. I actually like just beat Bowser right before recording this. And, I found the levels in the demo of the U version so much improved, like so much more in line with what I want in a Mario game. Like it's really, it seemed to me like the evolution of Super Mario World, which is really what I want. More secrets inside each level.
Yeah.
Really, like, Mario was more fun to control. Like, the power-ups were smarter. Like, we've already talked about this, in the previous podcast. But,
yeah,
like, it's... I thought it was a fantastic game. And going back right now to the Wii version, like, the game looked so much better on the Wii U. Not just like an increase in resolution, but there was like more details, more effects. Yeah, I can't wait to play it again.
Just better artwork. You know, like it feels like they gave a lot more attention to making all the, you know, because the shapes of, I mean, there's, it's still 2D Mario, right? Mm-hmm. So you've still got all these kind of shapes that you're running across that are very familiar. But, you know, at least they took some effort to kind of spice them up and make them look slightly different, you know, than they have in previous games. Whereas I always felt the Wii game, like there's some stuff going on in the backgrounds that kind of hints at this world being sort of bigger and more interesting than you remember from your childhood, but they didn't go very far in that direction. And on the Wii U game, it looks like they're really trying to make this look like, you know, it's kind of the next generation of 2D Mario. Like they really want it to look kind of new.
Yeah. And, like going back today to the Wii version after playing the Wii U version, it's just like the game looked so much more plain than I remembered. It's just,
it's a very bland game.
Yeah, it really is.
I mean, it's almost cynically bland. I mean, you're just like, oh.
And that game sold like 15, 20 million copies or whatever.
Yeah, it Black Ops'd it basically.
Scary. Yeah. But the Wii U game does look a lot better.
Yep. You can watch me actually playing on YouTube, and I got compliments for my playthrough. So
nice.
I feel pretty awesome. Yay, I'm a Mario expert.
Nice. It's almost as if the Miiverse already exists.
Wow. No, let's hope. Let's hope it's not like a YouTube comment section, please.
If it did, it would take 30 minutes for his comment to show up.
Yeah. Well, keeping on the Mario train, I will talk a little bit about New Super Mario Bros. 2.
I was much less impressed.
Yeah. So this is the game for 3DS. They only brought it out on the last day of E3 for some insane reason.
So let me say that when they did the second press conference on Wednesday night, we rounded up the people who weren't fatigued from home team to working to death, and Carmine, who was fatigued from home team for working for death, but kept working anyway. So good on him. And we basically sat there and watched it, waiting for any news to come out at all.
Mm-hmm.
Like we had five guys in the shoot in order to hand out news stories as they came up. We got through the first guy.
And that was
So at one point it got so boring. I actually dozed off for a minute and woke up in the middle of 3Diots and said, "What the fuck is this?"
Yeah, 3Diots.
So anyway, I played New Super Mario Bros. 2, and you know, there's just not a lot to say about it. It feels very, very, very much like the original New Super Mario Bros. On DS. And I played it with the D-pad, but you can play it with the circle pad as well.
I played it with circle pad. It played well. But yeah, like the Wii U version is like kind of like a sequel to Mario World, and I would say that New Super Mario Bros. 2 is definitely a sequel to the first one on the DS. Like it looks the same, it plays the same, it's got the same music. Like it's incredible how much of a copy it is.
And again, this is a much more powerful system, and it just doesn't look any different, you know. And I'm not saying this game should be a graphical showcase, but at least give me the impression that you've learned something in the past 7 years since the first game in this series, and it really looks the same.
Yeah, did it look to you like they had forgotten to put the 3D effect in?
Yeah, I turned it on, but I didn't really notice the 3D.
Yeah.
So I, yeah.
At least give us that. It's called the 3DS.
Maybe
please.
It was in there and it was just too subtle or whatever, but. It definitely did not leave me with a strong impression of the 3D effect, which made it look even more like the original DS game. And it plays the same, you know. I did kind of crack up at the dry piranha plants, you know, and there was some kind of clever riffs on familiar themes of Mario games like that. The coin stuff is like, look, getting coins is, it is pleasurable in this kind of nostalgic sense, you know, with the sound effect and the counter going up and, you know, but we've been getting coins in Mario games for 25 years. So over 25 years. And, you know, that alone is really not a strong mechanic to build your new game around. So, you know, there are some things I think they could do to make it exciting. And we have seen hints in the videos
make it a different game.
Well, some of the comments they've made, you know, they talk about, you know, your goal is to get 1 million coins, and, you know, I don't know why that would be fun, just to set some arbitrary number.
Well, it was fun in Wario. Like, the first one, Wario Land, like, you could upgrade your castle. I don't know.
Yes.
Like, I liked it at the time.
I don't think Mario's going to be upgrading his castle, but maybe. You know, if they give you some larger goal that actually is tangible and so, like that, you know, if they give you something to do with this money, or if they make you really care about getting 1 million coins rather than just saying this is a number you have to get. Also, I'm thinking, you know, I know a lot of people have said, why didn't they use this idea for a new Wario game? It would make a lot more sense thematically. And I'm starting to think, what if Wario is the final boss of this game? Like, you know, Wario was originally a final boss character. Like, he was the antagonist to Mario. What if they brought him back and actually made these two guys fight each other again? That would actually be pretty cool. It might only be a tiny piece of the game, but at least it would give you the sense that, oh, wow, this is something they haven't done in a very long time.
Because, I mean, we will get the chance twice this year to beat the shit out of Bowser in separate games.
Yeah,
I hope
they actually go somewhere different with it. I think they could. It's a good opportunity to do that.
I mean, the problem, though, is that if they're going to use Wario, I want it to be weird. You know, I want it to be like 6 golden coins. I want to fight a boss who's a rat who wears sunglasses.
Yeah, or go through a level that's a giant robot version of Mario for no reason.
Like, not only do you not really get any weird stuff, but you're basically getting nothing new. Like, the Wii U demo had, like, new enemies, new power-ups, new music, and NSMB2 had none of that. Like, it's the same old enemies, it's the same music. I had my headphones on, and like that was...
Yeah, the levels felt exactly the same as you would expect from all the other Mario games. I mean, there's really nothing new in terms of the level design that I saw. I mean, there were 3 levels there, and they were all from different styles of levels. So I think they had a good chance to really show us something cool that we hadn't seen before, and they didn't. You know, I got the golden fire flower, and I turned everything into coins, which feels ridiculously overpowered. And I just don't know what the point of that is, you know, so...
There are a few things that I did like, though. Like, while in the Wii U game, like, you get 1-ups up the wazoo still, in this one, I didn't really notice my lives increasing, like, but I certainly didn't find any 1-up mushrooms.
Right.
And instead, like, you find these golden mushrooms, which award, like, 50 coins, or in certain cases, they gave 100. And they seem to be pretty cleverly hidden.
Yeah.
And so, like, I think that's going to be fun to go after.
Well, and I don't think you earn 1-ups from getting coins, because that would kind of make the game even more ridiculously easy than most Mario games.
I think I read somewhere that you earn them from, like, gaining, like, 1,000 coins instead of 100, but I'm not sure. I'm not sure how people would know that.
I want you to be able to generate coins and then just spit them at people. Like a
point attack mode.
Like a fucking Meowth. Just start throwing coins at things.
are we going to be able to gamble in this game?
Nope.
I hope so. Online
I'm
gambling.
Thinking
that's what
no.
I want. Betting on sports in a Mario game. That's what I want.
At the end of every stage of Wario Land, you could risk it all.
It's true. You know, the other thing that they announced at the 3DS software showcase, if you can call it that, was this 2-player simultaneous mode. And I think Nintendo feels this is a much more important feature than it actually is, because the problem is they've already done 4-player on Wii.
Yeah.
So, and they're doing 5-player on Wii U.
You can play
the
whole game.
So 2-player just doesn't look
all
that impressive in comparison.
And,
you know?
and it's not online. I mean, my God, do something. Yeah.
It's
do
not online.
Something.
And the other thing is, I mean, this, you know, you're playing these on handhelds. It's going to take 2 3DSs to play this mode. So the advantage of this format is that each person has his own screen, which you would think would give you the opportunity to have each person have a different view. So the characters could separate. You could kind of, you know, divide and conquer the levels, you know, to try to get the best scores or whatever. No, instead, the camera's locked to the first player and the other one just kind of falls off if you, you know.
It
so
makes
you,
no sense.
It's just it doesn't make any fucking sense. You know, it's like you're not actually even using the hardware for what it's good at. You know, this is something that you couldn't do on Wii. And now you can on 3DS, but you're not doing it. I just I don't get it. You know, I think it's a feature that some people will use, and it's great that they're including it, but this is not much of a selling point. I hope the game is good, but to me, this was their best chance to show a lot of people what's really cool and exciting about it, and they did a very poor job.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, it may be that's it. There isn't anything cool or exciting about it.
That's what I'm afraid of.
I've heard someone try to play up the whole Street Pass thing, but like Street Passes are like, I'm going to be enjoying it, but like so many people can't, you know, like if you don't live in an urban area, then forget about it.
It definitely sounds like a better implementation than 3D Land had. So, I mean, what I am excited about with the Street Pass mode is the idea that they give you these three levels and you have to play them in one life. And there's no one-ups, period. You have to play through them in one life. If you fail, you fail. So that could give it this kind of Geometry Wars back and forth competitiveness. And it could also mean that, you know, you play through the main game and it's piss easy because you get 1,000 lives all over the place, right? Mm-hmm. But it does, you know, the idea of having this mode where they really kind of force you to be really, really good. And they're trying to play this tension between you playing the levels quickly and getting lots and lots of coins, but also playing conservatively enough that you can actually make it through without dying. That is interesting. And it could give you something to do long after you've beaten the main game. If you're actually a really skilled player. The fact that it's contingent upon getting street passes is the main problem here. It's an issue of access, I think.
What I wanted from this game all along was for them to come out and say, this is why it's different than New Super Mario Bros. Wii. What they came out and instead said, this is why it's a marginal improvement over New Super Mario Bros. And for me, that was such the wrong move to make, especially if they were showing the Wii U game. I mean, honestly, I feel like one of these games, there should have been a meeting at Nintendo where the producers of both these games were brought together and said, fight to the death, one of you gets to keep your game.
Yeah. Well, if you're going to have the series continue in parallel, one on handheld, one on console, you need to do a lot more to differentiate those. And that gets to the heart of my question to Mr. Tezuka at the Q&A the previous night when they were showing the Wii U game.
Which made the video despite the non-answer.
Right. I mean, even though they totally dodged it, and I don't know how involved he is in the 3DS game. I mean, he was on the Iwata Asks talking about it. So look, he's been involved in practically every Mario game since 1985. I hope he's supervising it at least. But if this guy is Mario, this guy's probably more the DNA of Mario than Miyamoto, okay? Mm-hmm. And if he can't really express to me how these two games that are coming out within 3 months of each other are distinctive and they're on completely different kinds of systems, we have a problem here.
But Johnny, they were made by two different teams.
Different teams!
That makes all the difference.
So they can't be the same. Like, there's no risk of that.
Yeah. it's a mess. I mean, I still think there could be like a, you know, an October surprise. I mean, it is possible that there's some big feature of this game or there's just something about it that is really exciting that we don't know yet, but.
Like, if there's a big feature about this game that we should know about, they would have mentioned it. I mean, there's just no reason not to have, unless they're deliberately trying to give the Wii U game all the credit, but at which point, why even show? Just hold the 3DS game for another year.
Who can understand what Nintendo decides and to show and not to show at E3? I mean, it makes no rhyme or reason to me.
Yeah, it really feels like the decision to make this game was taken like in a rush, like a desperate attempt to revive the 3DS, and then like probably like just before they actually dropped the price and the 3DS started doing well. But they should have, you know, put the brakes once they saw that the 3DS would be.
Let this game go. Give it another year.
Yeah.
I agree. And look, ultimately, I'm just a little Mario'd out already on 3DS. I mean, can we please get a first-party 3DS game that does not feature Mario or Luigi? You know, Luigi's Mansion at least is totally different kind of game, but how many fucking Mario games do we need on 3DS? Really?
Yeah, I mean, I was like, Castlevania, thank you.
At the press conference, they showed us three 3DS games, and they're all Mario. Holy shit! Don't you have other franchises?
I honestly thought they were trolling at that point.
Oh.
Yeah.
But yeah, I think we're all going to be fine with Luigi's Mansion and Paper Mario this, you know, this season, this holiday season. And like, they could easily have pushed back to New Super Mario for next year.
Yeah, but it's like their investors want it so badly, you know. I mean, you look at the sales of the last couple of games and they're just astronomical. And ultimately, that's kind of my issue. I don't really feel like this is being made out of some creative need to make more Mario games. I think it's made out of a financial need to get that shit on the shelf. And that's just not what you expect out of Nintendo. That's not what we want, you know.
Well, typically in the past, even though they probably were making games just exactly for that, they were probably a bit more creative than this.
Yeah.
So it was at least masked by the fact that, hey, wow, this is something new and different. Right.
There was a show of effort. The problem is, though, that when New Super Mario Bros. Wii came out, or the original New Super Mario Bros., definitely, but when the Wii one came out, there was still a gulf of 2D platforming games. There just hadn't been that many in a while. And what was really good about the game was that it was one, and it showed off, you know, a sort of revivalist sentiment that existed within the gaming community. Now there's a fucking huge stream of 2D multiplayer action platforming games that are all very much in this style that you can play. And in fact, they showed one at their own press conference that looks way more impressive than either of these games. And they're not making it. In terms of new ideas, at least. In terms of new ideas, at least, it's definitely a more interesting game.
Sure, and I thought that like Rayman would be my game of the show, but it turned out to be like I actually look forward to Mario Wii U a little bit more. Maybe just because like we played Rayman so recently, and when you're not playing on the tablet, like it does it play exactly the same as Legends? Origins?
I expected it did. That's a little bit disappointing, but I can understand. But, I mean, New Super Mario Brothers is, well, it's New Super Mario Brothers. I mean, to an extent, I can punish Ubisoft a little bit, but at least they're doing something significantly new. Near as I could deduce from the New Super Mario Brothers videos I saw with the tablet, it doesn't feel like they're doing that.
Implementation is a little dodgy, but here's the thing that you can't appreciate if you haven't actually played the demo, but it felt so much better than the Wii game and so much better than the DS game and so much better than the 3DS game. And that's why I'm totally on board with Guillaume here. I was much more enthusiastic about it, and it is definitely one of my favorite Wii U demos that we played this year, just because this feels like they really nailed the feel of Mario that has been a little off for me in the new Super Mario Brothers series so far.
Yep.
So let's wrap up new business. So we've got lots more E3 talk to come in listener mail right after this break.
Or do we?
Hey everybody, it's Johnny. Just to introduce you to a series of interviews that we did at E3 last week. First up, I've got Cloudberry Kingdom. Next is The Last Story. Then we have an interview about the Zelda Symphony of the Goddesses that happened during E3. And finally, Epic Mickey Power of Illusion. So I hope you'll enjoy these. I do want to warn you that the audio quality varies a little bit. We used various microphones, and these locations where we did the interviews tended to be pretty noisy, so I did a lot of filtering and amplification to try to get everything to sound pretty consistent, but it's not perfect. I hope you'll bear with me. It's just kind of the logistics of the situation, but I think they're really interesting, and I definitely want to thank all the developers and creative people who we talked to, the translators, of course, and finally, Jared Rosenberg, Michael T.Y.P. Cole, and Neil Ronahan for their tremendous help in scheduling and recording these interviews. By the way, if you're not interested in these games or the interviews in general and just want to get on with the show, you can always skip ahead in the iTunes or AAC version to the next chapter, and Guillaume will have that set up so that you can get right back into the normal podcast. So thanks and enjoy.
Hi everyone, this is Johnny. I'm here with the guys from Pony Studios. Can you tell me your names, please?
Jordan.
And I'm TJ.
All right, guys. So Pony is making the new game Cloudberry Kingdom, a 2D platformer for PC, Mac, and Wii U. And first off, I'd like to ask you guys, what made you want to bring this to Wii U, and what's the process been like so far in doing that?
Right. Well, the real inspiration for the game is all the old classic platformers, Mario and all that. We really wanted to bring back that feel of hardcore. You know, Mario 3, Mario 1, they're actually hard games. We wanted to bring back that feel. And Wii was the place to do it. I mean, you know, bring it back to the origins.
Agreed.
All right, so the game, I've played the beta, and it's a really, really interesting game, and it is definitely hard. It gets hard pretty fast. And the crazy thing about it is that the levels are randomly generated, but they don't feel like some computer sort of randomly slapped the elements together. They really feel like someone designed these levels, and I was really impressed by that, and I'm really kind of fascinated at how you pulled that off.
Cool. I'm glad you liked it. I mean, actually, we have some people play the game without even knowing that it's random, right? It feels like it's designed, and that's because it is designed. We actually taught an artificial intelligence how to design levels. So we kind of encoded all of our own knowledge about level design, you know, flow and player expectation and spacing, all this stuff, and we taught the AI how to take all this into account while designing the levels. And it does it while guaranteeing levels are possible, while controlling for difficulty, and really just letting you kind of specify parameters. You can be like, you know, give me a lot more fireballs, give me more fire spinners, whatever, and it'll do all that while doing everything else. And, you know, in a good design, hopefully. We think, and yeah. I'm glad that you think so, too.
Yeah. All right, so you just finished your Kickstarter campaign successfully. And partway during that process, when we started covering this project, was when you announced that this game would be coming to Wii U and that the Kickstarter supporters would be able to choose the Wii U version as their sort of gift for supporting a project instead of the Steam version. I think we're all pretty surprised about that, considering the Wii U eShop had not been announced at the time, right. And I don't know that Nintendo's really ever done this with an indie developer before, so... Right. We'd really like to know, how did you pull this off?
Our biz dev guy, actually, Michael, who's standing off over here, is really just some sort of magician. And our relationship with Nintendo has really just been great. I mean, they're really excited about Cloudberry, and they've just been a pleasure to work with so far. So we kind of just shot them an email, and we're like, hey, we want to do this for the Kickstarter. Can we do it? And they said, yeah, let's do it. They don't... I don't think we know exactly what the infrastructure is going to be like for it. I think they're... They're probably having like 20 engineers work on it right now just for us. they've been great about it. So,
yeah, that's awesome. And do you expect that you'll be able to get this game out fairly soon, as close to the PC Mac version? And do you think you'll be able to support it with updates after the fact like you might for a PC or Mac game?
Yeah. So actually, we were just talking to Nintendo just recently about the update process. And they've really streamlined it. It's something where you can, you know, get an update out within a week or two, whereas previously the QA process was, you know, a month or two. So we're really looking forward to pumping out new content, which is really easy for us because the AI really lets us, you know, you just assign an obstacle and you give it to the AI and you're like, hey, man, just make 100 levels for it. And right. It's like, sure. So it's really easy for us to just crank out this content, and we really want to do that. So.
Excellent. And do you have an idea for a timetable of when the Wii U version might be coming out?
Well, you want to launch with Wii.
We want to be there with the launch, yeah.
Yeah. All right.
And that will be when? Gotcha. All right, guys. I think that's all we have time for, so thanks very much.
Cool, thank
and
you.
Good luck with the game.
Thank you.
Hi, everyone. This is Jonathan Metz. I'm here with Mr. Matsumoto and Mr. Soga from XSEED Games to talk about The Last Story. And I wanted to start off by asking Mr. Matsumoto if you could describe your role on this game.
He was the development director, and he was in charge of the level design as a lead level designer and a lead programmer for this game.
Many of our listeners and viewers and readers know that this game comes from the mind of Mr. Sakaguchi as well. And I wonder if you could describe what is his involvement with this particular game? What aspect of the game did he work on as well?
So overall, he was he created a scenario of the individual characters and the worldview of this game. But after the development started, he was involved in every single small aspect of the game, like the timing of certain things. And he was playing the game every day. So every day we were getting like emails from him from Hawaii to like what to do, what to revise.
From what I know about The Last Story, it seems like it combines some very interesting gameplay mechanics from RPGs as well as action games, maybe strategy games as well. So I wondered if you could tell us a little about some of the influences, some of the ideas, maybe some other games that you had in mind that you wanted to maybe combine different elements of as well as your original ideas.
So I guess the starting point was he worked on Blue Dragon with Sakaguchi-san, and then that was a total turn-based system that but they wanted to have that same concept but modernize it. So to able to do that, Sakaguchi-san and him talked about it a lot, and they wanted to make a real-time combat system, but if it makes it just a real-time combat, it just makes it too busy, that it doesn't give that little moment to actually think about what to strategize. And so for that part, they really used Gears of War and Assassin's Creed as a reference to like come up with like a system that it's a real-time battle system, but it gives players to think about what to strategize the battle situation. So that was one of the things that they worked on to make this game.
Well, I know a lot of our fans have been following the story of this game since it was first announced in Japan and have been hoping for it to come to first Europe and now America for a long time. I wondered if the development team in Japan was familiar with the efforts of the grassroots organizations like Operation Rainfall to achieve an American release for this game.
We did hear that there's some kind of movement in Japan, in America. Then, yeah, just as a developer, I was really happy to hear something like that.
Not very many games like this were made for the Wii. We always wanted there to be more of them, so that's part of the reason why so many people were looking forward to this one and are going to be excited to play it now. I wonder if you could describe your experience working with the Wii hardware, perhaps comparing to other systems, and whether you had any difficulties in bringing such a large game and such a very complicated game and also very beautiful to this hardware that's not as powerful as some others.
So, just technically speaking, like the capacity of what we can hold, like on the disc and whatnot, there's a lot of information that you actually can put. So, in a media prospect, like he worked on the 360 before, like Xbox 360, so he had the know-how of creating like visually pleasing and like complicated games, but it was just to make that into a Wii. So, it wasn't more like a difficulty, it was just like taking out like what's unnecessary and just keeping what's necessary, and then forming that shows best in a Wii format. So one of the things they really want to concentrate was like to make the game as simple as possible, but at the same time, in the very beginning, it's a little difficult because on the right hand stick, there's no actual like analog stick to like, you know, change the camera view around on the Wii pad. Wii controller, but there are ways that, like pushing one button, you can go into that like covering system and then like, you know, peek out and check out what you want to see in the first person view. And when you're using the crossbow, you can actually use the crossbow to see where you want to do, but you won't be able to move in those situations. But I think because it made it like difficult to do more stuff, it made it the game simpler, which was easier for users to use.
Very nice. And I guess my final question for today is I wondered, Jimmy, if you could speak from XC's perspective, perhaps, on how this came to be. It seems to me a very unusual and momentous occasion that a third-party publisher is releasing a game that Nintendo published in Japan. So I wonder if you could describe how that relationship formed and how we came to this area. And I should say probably we hope this will be fruitful in the future as well.
Yeah, we get a lot of the cat question, but we were just extremely lucky and just, I think all the planets just lined up in the same time. But, our president had like a good contact with Nintendo and, he knew Sakaguchi-san himself. So we were working with other projects. So, but mainly it was just like writing love letters to, Nintendo, and we knew that they weren't going to publish it. So, and we always look at like what kind of quality games are out there, and this like totally matched our lineup because we usually specialize in RPG, especially JRPGs, and it was a story based, and it was something that we really wanted to do, and they surprisingly agree with what we had in mind. So we were lucky enough to publish this over here.
Well, that's great. Congratulations, and I know we're looking forward to it, and thank you both very much for your time.
Thank you.
Hi everyone, this is Johnny here with 2IP, and we're speaking with Jaron Moore. And Jaron, could you tell us your title and your role in the Zelda Symphony of the Goddesses tour?
So I'm the producer and the creative director. it's funny, I'm remembering back to when we actually came up with the name of Symphony of the Goddesses, and it was so natural. Chad and I were kicking back and like just imagining what it would be like to do a show like this before we even brought it to Nintendo. And so I sat down and started, you know, putting all my ideas on paper and And then, you know, of course, his bulk of his work as the music director and arranger didn't come till much later. And then, and by that time, we took it to them, and it transformed into what was what everyone would know as the 25th anniversary symphony.
Right.
Of course, Symphony of the Goddesses was the show that we had always that we kind of brought to Nintendo first and foremost, and they wanted to do the 25th anniversary symphony first as a special commemorative engagement.
So then how are the two different?
There are a lot of arrangements on the 25th anniversary symphony that you're never going to hear in concert again. It's really neat that some of those arrangements have been preserved on the CD that came with Skyward Sword. Mm-hmm. But there are a bunch of arrangements on from that concert that aren't on the CD. And were either of you at it?
I was at the
cool.
in L.A.
So you know that the boss battle medley, that's so cool.
Yeah, I was curious as to how you decided what songs to leave, what songs to trim out. You know, it seemed like this was a little more well-rounded, you know, lean and mean package compared to the 25th. So what work was done after the fact, looking at it, say, well, how do we want to bring this for the masses?
To me, all these concerts are just a big celebration of, I mean, first and foremost, Zelda, but very closely behind, you know, Koji Kondo's work and those of his team. And so those 25th anniversary concerts were really Kondo-san's, that was Kondo-san's big celebration. He's very involved in structuring that and contributing a lot of the arrangements. We had half of the arrangements for the show belong to us that we had developed and for this show, and then he brought in the other half, which were all those arrangements that, you know, if you were there, you got to hear them, and that's how they wanted it. They wanted it to be a. Either you're in Tokyo, you're in Los Angeles, or you're in London, and you're lucky enough to be there if you came all the way to see it or happen to live in those cities, and it's going to be a special thing that people will never experience again. But the catch there is that they you know, the response was so great, and I think they knew they know how much the fans love the franchise. They wanted to keep it going, and so that's where Symphony of the Goddesses sort of rolled in, and allowed us to just expand on our original vision, and tell the story that we wanted to tell. And as huge just Zelda nerds that Chad and I are, we got to kind of dig deep into the narrative and present it the way you heard it tonight.
So could you talk a little bit about the challenges in putting together a production like this and going from city to city?
The biggest challenge is kind of, I mean, and this is more of a creative challenge, is kind of, you know, meeting our own expectation, because just being so into the music and, you know, there's just so much that you can't fit into the show. I mean, tonight we had, you know, about 90 minutes of music. That's a really full concert. Most of the concerts out there are not gonna be quite that long. So I mean, it's a lot of music. You got to keep people's attention. We had a few surprises at the end, which are always fun.
Much appreciated. I'm also a big Majora's Mask fan.
Yeah. Excellent. It sounded like we had a bunch of them out there.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
So that one's fun to kind of say at the very end.
And that was a recent addition?
Yeah.
The program?
Yeah. It was, we added, I think, 5 shows ago. So it was, that was really fun to do, and people just really wanted it.
Yeah.
So, but, you know, traveling from show to show, we get to work with a different orchestra in every city. Mm. And it's just a lot of fun because every orchestra has kind of a different personality and how the music actually, I mean, this music is burned into my brain, whether it's from, you know, growing up with it or, you know, now having heard these particular arrangements so many times. But every time we go to a new city, and I don't know what we're doing up there.
Taking a stage apart, I think.
I guess.
So you can pick out the differences even from city to city and how the different musicians play it.
Yeah, there's just very subtle kind of a subtle temperament to just how things are expressed or, you know, and that keeps it fresh. Of course, you know, it's a new show to every city that we go to for that audience. And as fun for this one, for the one that coinciding with E3, because I was walking around E3 and I was seeing our t-shirts, and people who were actually going to be coming to the show that had already seen it.
That's where we were all day.
Yeah. I had made a brief appearance earlier today, and I was like, before I could even get into the convention center, I was regretting trying to make it. Like happened.
Yeah. Oh, it's logistically. I mean, we came afterwards, and it's real tough.
Unfortunately, there aren't any Zelda games this year.
No. Well, there's Battle Quest.
Sure,
there's that. That was kind of fun.
Yeah. I'm curious. You know, you were talking about going from city to city, and it sounds like you work pretty directly with the different orchestras, and you must hear from the musicians a lot. I'm wondering what their feedback is on the music. Are they familiar with it? And if not, what do they think of it?
The neat thing about Zelda is that every orchestra will find it's kind of cool. We'll have at least two or three players in there that are young enough to have like actually played the games. So when we're in rehearsals and stuff, you know, even before we start performing in a rehearsal, you know, they're looking through the music and just kind of starting to, you know, jam with it. Like they're like, okay, I remember this. This is going to be fun. And then, I mean, we have older, you know, older musicians as well who, if they haven't played the game, they've heard of it. I mean, that seems to be the common denominator, is that everyone has at least heard of it, and it's either from their children or grandchildren, or they've played it themselves. But I don't think it is until they all come out on stage and the curtains come back and, you know, Emer walks out and performs that first overture and we get our first feedback from the audience that it clicks how special it is. Yeah. And, I mean, I'm a big video game music guy, just period. I mean, I love music and games. But Zelda has always like held a real special place in my heart, and so doing this show and seeing all those colors come out of the orchestra and really make it, the whole goal is to make it bigger and better than you remembered, and really tap into the nostalgia. So, you know, not do anything that changes the essence of what you remember, but like, I mean, you can go listen to that music anytime, but sitting in the audience and hearing it in a way that is, I think this might be the closest we'll get to a Zelda movie until one is made. And that was sort of my...
That'll be a long, long time.
Yeah, and that was sort of my, like, that was what was so fun about, you know, going through all the footage, and I edited a lot of it. And so putting the visuals back to the music and creating these, like, these hybrid music video / you know, cinematic, you know, films that had these awesome epic scores.
Yeah. So you actually played through the games and snapped together?
I worked with the video team at Nintendo. So what I would do is I'd go online and download a bunch of like, I'd go like watch all my favorite like Let's Play guys, you know. You know, I'd go find Tobuscus playing or something. And no, not really. But and then I would concept the video out with what I wanted it to look like. Mm-hmm. And then I'd send that up. And you know, all the basic beats and edits would be in there, and then Nintendo would give me some feedback, and we'd tweak it. And then once we established what all our shots would be, they would have someone go and capture it, and they would send the footage back to me, and I'd slowly kind of plug it in. Now, I mean, even the act of capturing is almost, there's some acting involved, because you can put someone down a video game, but unless they're playing it with a certain personality, and sort of like, you almost have to like, I'm not playing it as Jaren, I'm actually, this is Link, and this is like, this is the most ideal playthrough, like, no freaking, like, I'm not gonna roll through, you know, roll straight across Hyrule Field to get from point A to point B, you gotta walk, you know, or run, and so, you know, I would toss notes back to them saying, okay, come on, can you make that jump a little bit more convincing? Or, you know, when you do this battle, will you actually go, you know, pivot to the right, to the left, like the Ganondorf battle from Ocarina? That was a tough one.
I actually love the part where from Link to the Past, where Link and Zelda are trying to escape the castle and they go to the wrong side of the throne before they push it to the correct side. Because everyone does that.
Yeah. Right?
So, it definitely looks natural. It looks like when we played it, not when some tester played it.
Yeah.
The most efficient way.
Yeah. And I had a version where the guy, like, went straight up to it and, like, just did it naturally. And I plugged it in. And I was like, that just doesn't feel right. So, like, even the little mistakes, like, kind of make it feel better.
Yeah.
Give it heart.
I thought the videos were put together really nicely. And it has a funny effect. I've been to a lot of orchestral concerts before. I've never seen one with that kind of video content, and it was a pretty unusual experience. And I was thinking, you know, if we didn't have that, the arrangements of the music and the fact that they're being done with this very large orchestra might make it sound a little alien and a little less familiar than it does. And I think the video has a lot to do with that, because you have these moments and memories from the games that you associate the music with. Seeing that at the same time actually makes the music in this format feel more natural, and it almost makes it like fit right into the memories that you already have, and it makes it feel more, you know, I think maybe makes the audience feel more comfortable with the music in this format.
Mission accomplished.
Yeah.
That's awesome.
Yeah, nice job.
Thank you.
So we're running pretty short on time, I think. I did have one special request to ask you. At the end of this tour, will you release a new CD with all the new content that wasn't on the Skyward Sword disc?
That's, you know, all I can say is that's something that we're working on at this time, because the disc with Skyward Sword has been so close to release. Just Nintendo doesn't want to move forward quite yet, but send them your requests, and just, you know, I think they listen. So you bug them enough, maybe it'll do something.
Very nice.
So I would love to do that.
All right. Well, thanks, Jaron. We really appreciate your time.
Thank you.
Congrats on a great concert.
Thank you so much. Thanks for coming up.
Hey, everyone. This is Johnny. I'm here with Peter Ong from Dream Rift, and we're playing Epic Mickey Power of Illusion for 3DS. And this is the first time that any of us has gotten a chance to play the game. So I'm very excited as a fan of Monster Tail and Henry Hatsworth and Mickey Mouse games in general. So, Peter, I know that you and Warren talked at the showcase yesterday about this game being inspired by Castle of Illusion. And Warren also kept saying that it would be sort of based on the idea of Wasteland becoming a graveyard for the Disney video games. Now, does that include just Castle of Illusion, or are there other games as well included in that mix?
Anything goes in Wasteland. If it can be conceived of as no longer being, you know, completely popular in the public eye, then I think it's fair game for falling into Wasteland. I know that I've discussed the idea of different video games in addition to the Castle of Illusion falling into Wasteland, so I think that it wouldn't be a surprise to see more.
How about DuckTales? Anything like that?
Yeah, I can't really say too much, but if you notice already in the stuff that we've shown for Power of Illusion, you have characters from DuckTales, such as Scrooge McDuck.
And then how will all the different, the worlds interact? It seems like you're going to different worlds and basically interacting with characters. How do they fit into the story and also the gameplay?
Okay, so the basic premise of Power of Illusion is that, as mentioned, touched upon just now, the Castle of Illusion has just recently fallen into Wasteland as a forgotten object, and with it still retains its powers of illusion, and those come from the evil witch Mizrabel, who lives inside of the castle, and she's now a very unwilling inhabitant of Wasteland, having arrived in Wasteland as a forgotten character now, and she wants to get back out, but the way in which she does that is she uses her powers of illusion. So first and foremost, her power of illusion allows her to cloak herself as one of any number of Disney villains. So that's why you'll see in the demo and in the footage that we've shown so far, she looks like Maleficent, but she can turn into multiple Disney villains throughout the game. And then secondly, she uses her powers of illusion to cloak the castle in illusion. All of the levels that you play in this game will be drawing from different Disney film IPs. So you'll play through areas that are based in Peter Pan, for example, or Aladdin, for example. characters. The reason why all these characters that you normally wouldn't see in Wasteland are in there is because Mizrabel has also used her powers of illusion to draw their essences into the castle and trap them, and that's actually part of her plan in harnessing their energy in order to propel the castle and her back into the cartoon world.
So, Peter, I know that the games you've worked on and have come up with very creative ways to interact between the touchscreen and the upper screen. And the 3DS kind of is a different beast than the DS because the upper screen is so different than the touchscreen. It's not just a lack of touch. It's now in 3D as well. Can you describe how this game deals with that issue or takes advantage of it, and also how the interaction works in this particular game?
That was actually one of the things that brought us back eagerly towards exploring the dual screen interaction on this new Nintendo handheld. The fact that the top screen is stereoscopic immediately spoke to an opportunity that we saw that we didn't think we had seen before in any of the other 3DS games, and we wanted to take advantage of that right away. And it's the idea that since the bottom screen is 2D and the top screen can be projected in stereo 3D, we can show objects in real time crossing from the bottom screen where they're 2D, actually physically moving from 2D on the bottom screen to the top screen in stereoscopic projected 3D. When you paint an object in this game, you actually see it physically cross from the bottom to the top screen, and you see that transition in real time while it being half projected in stereoscopic 3D on the top screen and in 2D on the bottom. So I guess what was interesting to us about that is also tied into our approach in stereoscopic 3D in this game, which is it's not enough for us to just make another polygonal 3D game, you know, as 99% of the games on the 3DS are out there, where players just expect and shut off as the norm the idea that these are in 3D because you just expect these polygonal, you know, first-person shooters or driving games or whatever to just be in 3D, because that's what polygons do in the first place, is they try to simulate 3D, and when it's projected in 3D, it's just one step further to that illusion, right? But with our approach, we're actually punctuating our use of 3D by showing things transition from 2D to 3D from the top to the bottom screen, and in addition to that, our aesthetic is you know, based on hand-drawn, you know, traditional Disney approach to 2D art. And the difference there is that you're seeing things projected stereoscopically in 3D that you wouldn't normally expect to see projected with that kind of layering and depth as opposed to just a generic polygonal 3D game.
And your last game, Monster Tale, was a non-linear sort of Metroidvania-style game where you explored a big world that had backtracking and different upgrade powers. How does this game compare? Is it more linear? Do you still get these kind of upgrades that let you access different places?
That's a good question. This game's actually another interesting spin on the traditional platforming game structure. It's while it's not, you know, there's not a map screen like Monster Tale with a fully Metroidvania structure, it does play with the traditional structure of 2D platforming games. In that the levels are non-linear and have a lot of extra areas off the beaten path to explore where you can rescue a multitude of rescuable characters into your fortress, okay? So those are optional to rescue, but the second part in which the level structure is quite different, or the structure of the game, rather, is that in between levels that you've beaten, you can visit a totally different game mode called the Fortress. And the way that the Fortress works is that all of the characters that you've taken upon it yourself to rescue within levels go and reside in this safe haven called the Fortress that's inside of the castle. And Mickey, in between levels, can visit the characters he's rescued in the Fortress and interact with them for further storyline elements, but more importantly, he can perform quests specific to each of those characters that helps to evolve and grow the Fortress and those characters' rooms, and net Mickey rewards that help him to play more effectively within levels. So there's a sort of gameplay feedback loop between your gameplay levels and the Fortress, in that you find the characters in gameplay levels, then in the Fortress you interact with those characters to get rewards that then help you to become more effective in gameplay levels.
So what kind of quests would you be performing? Would you be going back and replaying previous levels?
Yeah, that's actually another major reason why the levels are less linear. The types of quests that can be performed in the Fortress with characters are many and varied. You have what you mentioned, where characters will ask you to find objects that they need back in gameplay levels. So you'll have to jump back into a gameplay level. It can either be a gameplay level that you've beaten already or a new one. It just varies per quest. But if you have to go back into a gameplay level that in order to find something for a character to fulfill their quest, that level can actually be different gameplay-wise, and you might access things that you hadn't before in order to get that object. But that's just one of many types of different Fortress quests. Other characters' Fortress quests will actually ask you to paint things indirectly to their rooms, and then other ones will ask you to do fulfill quests for them by talking to or bringing other characters in the Fortress to them.
I think that's all the time we have. Thanks very much, Peter.
Thank you.
Here's a quick look at the best original content at our website, now playing at NintendoWorldReport.com.
Last week was E3, so we have a ton of impressions, starting with impressions of LEGO City Undercover by both Guillaume here and Aaron Kaluska. It's the LEGO adventure game that you might actually want to look into, more than just your average LEGO title. We also have impressions of Project P100 by multiple staff members, but I read Michael T.Y.P. Coles, a reference here. It's an action game that has a little bit of Pikmin in it and a little bit of just crazy chaos.
Aaron has impressions of the Netflix on Wii U with exclusive video. I think that Chris Kohler from Wired linked to that video and gave us praise for it, so that's pretty cool. Also, check out my impressions of Night Sky. It's a game coming out soon on the eShop from Nicholas, and look forward to this deceptively simple puzzle platformer with more emphasis on the platforming than you might think.
Some impressions that I wrote up from E3 that you might have missed are for Sports Connection. This is the Ubisoft sort of Wii Sports replacement title that is, despite the very generic name, actually a lot more interesting than you might expect, so you can read up more on that. And we've got impressions of Skylanders Giants, the Wii game. Zach Miller wrote up impressions from E3 of the newest way to sell you plastic figures.
All right, and we have a ton of previews from E3. Special credit goes to Alex Kulafi for his prolific previewing. I know we have just a ton of those to sort through. And then we have the Best of E3 2012 awards, so you can check out what we thought were the best and the worst games and probably other things. Other experiences of E3 2012.
Other experiences.
And then on the review front, we have, hoo-wee, we got Mad Dog McCree, baby. So, so you can watch that, since you actually don't play it, as Johnny has reminded me. You can watch that one on your 3DS and see exactly what we thought of that one.
What did we think of that one, John? I bet it was good.
it's probably a wily varmint.
Yep, so how can you resist heading over to NintendoWorldReport.com after that pitch? But while you're over there, be sure to check out all of the great news and screenshots and videos that we've been posting from E3. We're still catching up on additional impressions and previews from after we got home from the show. And of course, you can participate in our excellent, very long-standing forum community.
Excellent's
well.
A strong word. Also, be sure to check out the Nintendo World Report exclusive YouTube feed that has the tremendous videography work of Jared Rosenberg.
That's right.
Having missed E3 this year, this is how I live it vicariously.
All right, we are back, and it's time for listener mail. The address is rfn@nintendoworldreport.com. You can also go to the show notes for this episode and click on the link there and use the website to send us an email. And James has the first one this week.
I do. Adolf Vega from Texas writes.
Okay, hold on. Let's do these one at a time.
Yeah, that's what I was going to do.
Yeah. He sent us like this long list of like quick questions about stuff from E3. So let's just do them one at a time.
How does the Wii U gamepad feel in your hand?
It feels pretty good. I mean, it's pretty light. It feels like, you know, touching a dream. I don't know. Like,
get out. Get out.
Like, there's one thing that seemed weird to me, but maybe it's just like, maybe it was just taking time for me to adapt. But like, while playing Pikmin, I couldn't wrap my head around like the pressing A to, like, I can't even remember what it did, throwing the Pikmins and pressing the right second trigger to call them. Like, it seemed to me like it was not as natural as pressing A on the GameCube controller, which makes sense because that button was huge. But otherwise, like, it felt pretty good.
I mean, it's still just as light as ever, right?
Yeah, no, it was light.
Yeah, the gamepad is definitely noticeably heavier than the Pro Controller, but the Pro Controller is sort of designed for minimum weight, so you kind of expect that. It's also half the size.
The model that we were holding probably didn't have the battery, though, right? Like, they were tethered, so... the power had to come from there.
Right. I mean, we don't really know. That tether might have just been a power cable to continuously charge the battery. Yeah, I think the shoulder buttons that are on the edge, the top edge of the gamepad, are certainly not as hard to reach as the Z button on GameCube. But
well, that's not saying much.
They're not as quick access as I would like. I mean, I'm not sure. I feel like they should be a little more around the edge so that you don't have to reach up quite as far to hit them. Maybe it's something I'll get used to, but that I noticed a couple times. I felt like I had to reach a little bit farther to get them. Maybe it might also just have to do with the kind of action that they have when you do push them, you know, right. The way that they click, doesn't feel quite natural. And again, that you might get used to that or you might break them in. It's hard to say. The joysticks were good. The buttons were very good. The placement of the buttons was a little strange at first, you know, being below the thumbstick on the right side. It's not really a position that we've used on any other controller. And, I felt like I adapted to it pretty quickly. On the Pro Controller, a little bit harder because they're crammed closer together, and the bottom button, so that would be the B button on the Pro Controller that's at the bottom of the diamond, is almost hanging off the controller. Like, it is so low that it barely fits on there. I thought that was a little strange, but I could probably get used to it. But yeah, overall, felt fine. I mean, it felt very similar to the way the tablet felt last year at E3. And so I didn't register there being a lot of changes in how it felt.
There's one thing that probably should be mentioned. Nintendo, at least like if we play Nintendo Land, you're going to want to hold the gamepad vertically sometimes. And that felt good too, like the ridge that's underneath the tablet. Mm-hmm. Like I found that could be like a nice grip while you were trying to like throw shurikens at paper ninjas. So that felt pretty good.
Last year, that grip was all, that middle bar was really all they had, and that it felt a bit like holding a painter's palette if you held it sideways. Now they showed a lot more sideways stuff last year because they were trying to really show off. Oh, look how versatile this thing is. But, you know, he asks, how does it feel compared to last year? Obviously, the big addition is the grip, the side grips. Like, what's that like?
Didn't notice them.
Really?
I didn't notice them. I mean, they're the kind of thing that you would expect to come into play if you're playing for a longer period of time.
True.
And because there were so many fucking mini games at E3 this year on Wii U, none of the demos were very long, and so I felt like I never really got to play. Plus, a lot of the games that are shown were multiplayer, and so a lot of times you're swapping out controllers with other people, so you weren't necessarily even playing the entire demo with the gamepad.
Yeah, they seemed ergonomic enough, but you really can't tell.
I think it's a subtle change.
The other change, though, was they changed the control sticks.
Yep.
So, how do you feel about them? I mean,
way better.
So way he mentions, how do the analog sticks feel compared to Nintendo previous consoles?
They feel the same as on the classic controller, except they click.
Yeah, I would say so. And there's no, like, obviously, there's no indentation. Like, they go around 360 degrees.
They're smooth.
So, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So, it basically goes all the way back to the GameCube sticks, but smooth, basically.
I mean, yeah, without that little extra ridge in the middle.
Mm-hmm. Right, the blister ridge.
Yeah,
but does your thumb slide off of them though, like they do with the classic controller?
They're really like I don't think that I held the controller long enough to even tell. I mean,
I agree.
You'd have to kind of develop some sweat on your finger too to really get the worst case scenario.
Yeah, and like I don't think that any of the games shown were intense enough to instantly produce sweat. So
hey.
Zombie U came close, but you also were moving your hands off the joysticks quite often in that game to do things on the touchscreen. So
is the gamepad as big as it looks in pictures? It looks big.
It is really big.
Yeah. Is it bigger than last year?
I would say
it
looks almost as big as that game. Actually, it might be as big as the GameCube controller, keyboard controller.
Oh, the ASCII keyboard. Yes.
Yeah. Yeah, it might actually be about that size, because that's the thing. I mean, it's always surprising just how lightweight it is when you pick it up, because it is gigantic. It's huge.
Let's see. Does the black finish look vastly superior to white in person?
Yes. I think for white, they should make it more like the DSi kind of matte finish, because I think the shiny white plastic does not look good. I think the shiny plastic looks way better in black than it does in white.
So how many black units did they have there?
There was about half.
Oh, so it was a pretty good mix.
Yeah.
So based on your experience with console launches, Johnny, do you think it's a pretty fair assumption there's going to be a black Wii U?
Yeah, you know, for GameCube, they had two different colors. You could choose black or purple. I think that's what they're going to do this time as well. I think you'll be able to choose black or white. The black definitely looks better. But also, all my other game stuff is black, so I would prefer to, you know, just be consistent.
But based on what you saw at previous E3s as well, for the pre-GameCube launch, was it kind of like that where they had multiple units of color?
That I don't really recall.
No, actually, I remember they were all purple because they were still trying to push the purple thing, the branding.
Maybe so. I mean, it wasn't like, you know, when they first showed the Wii controllers back in 2006, they had like eight colors of them and they're all in this display case and people are taking pictures. And that's like a warning sign that these are our test colors, you know, and we're not actually going to release all of these. But when they've already narrowed it down to just two, that makes me a lot more confident that they're actually going to release both of those colors.
Right, especially since they showed, as you're saying, about half and half.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, like, I mean, the promo videos, the on-stage demos, a lot of those were using both black and white units. So I think it's pretty safe to say that probably both at launch, but certainly, you know, within a reasonable time frame, they'll be releasing both colors.
Okay, see, I'm going to combine two questions. Johnny doesn't like the 3DS touchscreen. How is it compared to that, and how does the touchscreen feel in person?
It feels pretty much like the 3DS touchscreen. Like obviously it's bigger, so like whatever that it is that you're touching is going to be like easier to accurately
a bigger target.
Yeah. Like I don't have a problem with the 3DS touchscreen.
Is it very very gentle touching, and you'll get registered?
No, nothing like on an iPhone. You definitely have to put a little bit of pressure.
But not a whole lot.
No. Like, for instance, like, probably, like, the most use that I made of the touchscreen was with the, what's the guy's name? Like, Ninja Maru or?
Oh, Takamaru.
Takamaru.
Yeah, so that Ninja Star throwing game, like, you have to slide very quickly your finger on the touchscreen. Mm-hmm. I initially, like, I thought, like, okay, I'm gonna try something that no one apparently has tried. Like, I'm gonna try to use the stylus. And that was kind of a disaster. Like, I don't think it gave me like more speed or more accuracy at all. And then I tried with my finger, and the you know, like, it slides well enough. Like, it's really, I think it gets the job done.
So Johnny, Mr. Hater, how do you feel about this particular screen?
Yeah, so it sounds like Guillaume feels like it's basically the same as 3DS. I feel that the Wii U gamepad screen is better than the 3DS. It's not as good as I would like. And I played both the Takamaru's Ninja Castle and the Game and Wario Arrow mini game, which are both very similar, and they both involve you turning the thing sideways, book style, and then flinging your finger across it to flick things up to the screen. And in both cases, it was not as responsive as I would have liked, and there were a couple of false negatives where I did the motion, but I wasn't pressing hard enough, apparently, and so the thing didn't actually activate. And that was annoying, and I noticed it, you know. Yeah.
But those kinds of games are, like, really, really quick-paced. Like, in Sports Connection, like, you could draw very – like, you could take your time, and you could draw very accurately, no? Like, in Sports Connection, you could basically draw the path that your ball would
take. Your pitches, Yes. I mean, Sports Connection had other, it was a little bit of a buggy demo. So you would draw certain pitches and they just wouldn't register and it would just do a standard fastball.
Right. But you would see in real time where you touched and the path that you were, you know, giving the ball.
Yes. But it's a different kind of motion, because in that game, you're drawing with your finger. So you're using the point of the tip of your finger. Mm-hmm. Your finger's kind of perpendicular to the screen. Whereas in those flick games that the Ninja Stars and the Arrows, you're kind of sliding the pad of your finger across the screen. And so you're not putting as much direct pressure on it. And so there's more ambiguity as to whether the screen recognizes whether you're actually activating it or not. Hmm. That's the problem. I think if you're using the stylus, you'll be perfectly fine. If you're kind of tapping on things, it feels better than it does on 3DS. I mean, to me, even like in the menu system of 3DS, the touchscreen isn't very responsive. And I don't know what the deal is. I think it's partly the algorithm that they use to determine whether you're sliding or tapping. So yeah. if your stylus or your finger moves just so slightly, then they think, oh, that wasn't an intentional tap, so we're not going to activate it. So I end up having to do things two or three times, quite frequently in order to activate it. And I didn't have that problem on the Wii U. So it could be better software. It could be better technology. I feel like the 3DS touchscreen has a thicker screen protector over it that impedes the responsiveness. And I felt like the Wii U screen had less of that issue. It felt like there's, you know, there, you can actually see it on your 3DS touchscreen, especially if you use a stylus. You can see the plastic bend downwards as you, yeah, as you touch it. And I felt like there was less noticeable effect of that on Wii U, which tells me that either the protective screen is thinner or it's mounted closer to the screen itself, or there's just something about it that they're doing that makes it feel less like you're having to poke through this protection in order to activate the screen. So I felt overall it was better, and it was a little better than I expect. I definitely felt it was better than last year at E3, and I think it's better than 3DS. It's not as good as I would like, but it's acceptable.
Right. So I'm going to skip the question about the Apple Retina display comparison, because we've already more or less covered that.
The touchscreen is, you know, it's not HD, but it's a small enough screen that it doesn't need to be HD, right?
Right.
I mean, the original iPad is not HD. And the thing about the touchscreen is that certain things will look surprisingly good on it. And, you know, and it will really be up to the developers a lot as to what they want to show on the screen.
Right.
But I would kind of compare it maybe to, it's kind of like a really big PSP screen in terms of like the resolution and the kind of, you know, the brightness of it. And it's definitely not like a Vita. I mean, Vita is like the ultimate luxurious screen.
I would still say it's a step above the PSP screen, or at least the PSP Go, which is what I know.
Yeah. And it's way better than the DSi XL screen. Cause I mean, the resolution is so much higher.
The XL screen is a saint.
On XL, things look blocky because the pixels are gigantic, you know? So it's much better than DSi XL. I would say it's hard to compare it to the 3DS top screen because it's not 3D and it's bigger, you know, but yeah, that's probably a good comparison as well. If you turn the 3D effect off, then it probably looks similar to the 3DS top screen.
So before you continue to make all kinds of terrible, terrible lies, will you actually want to play Wii U games on the Wii U screen instead of the TV?
Well, it really depends.
It
depends on the game. I thought that Trine looked really good, if perhaps like a little bit crowded with the icons. I think that's one of the, perhaps like one of the pitfalls that it could have. Like a lot of the demos liked to take away some of the interface, from the TV,
right,
and put it on the gamepad. If you're only playing on the gamepad, like, where are they going to put the interface? Well, they put it over what you're playing. So that's
right,
one problem that I can see.
You lose some real estate.
Yeah.
It's not really a problem because then you basically have the same display that you would have on any normal console game that has
right
to put everything on the TV. But it is a smaller screen than a TV. So I could see how things might start to look crowded.
Yeah. But for instance, like, I don't think that I would have a reason to play Scribblenauts Unlimited on the TV, and that's how I want people watching.
Right.
That seemed to be like a perfect type of game to play on the tablet.
Did you get a chance to play with Miiverse and the Wii U OS? And did you see anything made of the NFC feature on the Wii U gamepad?
No to all of the above.
Thought so. Has playing the Wii U in person made you want to buy one on day one?
It's so strange because, like, last year I was so convinced by the Shield Pose demo.
That demo is so good. Why was it not there?
I was, like, sold right then and there. And I thought that, like, wow, like, the whole technology of, like, using the gyroscope to, like, have the second window on the game, like, that really sold me. Like, I thought that this is way more responsive than anything on 3DS. But then, like, this year, we had, like, some calibrating problems, like, when sometimes switching from one game to the next. For instance, a lot of times playing the Game & Wario game where you would shoot arrows, all of a sudden, you would have to basically aim to the left of the TV if you wanted to hit anything. Like, it didn't make any sense. Like, you had basically the same problems that you sometimes get with the Wii Motion Plus. And at that point, like, I was actually a little bit less sold than the Wii U than before.
Now, is there any way to reset it?
Apparently there is.
Recalibrate?
Yeah, and I think that actually in some interview, like, that came up, like, they said, well, like, the components are, you know, like, we did try to go for affordable components, and you'll have to recalibrate occasionally, which is not something I wanted to hear.
Yeah.
But then, you know, like, the strength of the launch games is really what has sold me
right.
on the Wii U. Because yeah. I'm pretty sure that I'm going to be buying as soon as I can, like 6 or 7 games. I want them all. Like, they demoed really, really well. No,
well,
but seriously.
Can you run through those games then, just real quick?
Well, sure. Like, Mario, of course, Scribblenauts Unlimited.
Did you actually play Scribblenauts? I didn't think it was that good.
Seriously?
Yeah. I'm also not a fan of Scribblenauts. I've never been impressed with it. I think it's a great database and a shitty rules engine. I think if you don't solve the puzzle in exactly the way that they want you to solve it, then the ability to conjure whatever item you want is kind of pointless.
I don't know. I was sold by the demo. I made like a trampoline and a super kangaroo, and I gave it the jetpack and it was just super awesome. But yeah, like, and I wrote impressions.
That's what Australia's actually like, by the way.
Exactly. And it's all upside down.
And you know, like, probably like Lego City Stories and all of that stuff. I was really impressed by a lot of the games. Whether or not, like, they used the gamepad in a really novel way, like, that really didn't factor in. I just think that the launch games are pretty solid.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I want to buy a Wii U because I want to play, you know, Pikmin and Zombie U and Mario U at launch. And those are all launch games, so I want to play those at launch. Mm-hmm. Playing it in person is, there's nothing that I've seen about the way the controller is being used that makes me think, you know, that it's a huge selling point. The software is the selling point. And
right.
the games that I just described, of those, only Zombie U is really using the controller in a very innovative, you know, fascinating way so far.
So I know there was a Netflix demo there, but did you all get any impression of what Nintendo's grander strategy is as making this a device that you use for more than just games?
Well, I mean, you know, they've got the universal remote stuff and, you know, I mean,
right.
that kind of thing, a really, you know, if the Netflix app is the very best of on any platform, then I will certainly use that. And,
right.
you know, there's a few things like that that are appealing.
I mean, they talked about the all the video content that's going to be available. Which is quite a bit more than on the Wii. So I'm curious if they made any effort to show that, though.
Nope.
Awesome. Thanks, Nintendo. The best. Mm-hmm.
As a Canadian, I was not really, you know, interested by all the video options anyway. We usually get left out, so.
Yeah, they block everything.
Yeah.
How's that Hulu working out for you up there, Guillaume?
Yep. But that was all of his questions, so we can move on.
Awesome.
Yep. Thanks for the lightning round there. I hope it was instructive for a few people. And John has the next letter.
All right, Buttle writes, does the lack of Nintendo games at E3 say something about our next year of gaming, or does it say more about how Nintendo is opting to use E3?
Actually, I think it's because they fucking burned out the franchises in the last couple of years, and we're kind of in that weird that weird middle period where they have to kind of restock all these game developers. I mean, they basically...
I mean,
2010 was a blow. I mean, every Nintendo franchise basically got a game in 2010.
Yeah.
And anybody who got missed got picked up by 2011, including fucking Kid Icarus. I mean,
the thing is, it really goes back to the fact that they just really don't make a lot of new franchises anymore.
No, that is entirely a true statement. I mean, I just think that they sort of shot the whole load right there.
Yeah.
And so, to an extent, yeah, I think it does say a bit about what we have coming to us this year, but I think it says, to an extent, it says more about, well, they, you know, when you have prolific years like 2010, and I went back and reviewed some of the stuff we said, the commentary that came with it was, man, there's going to be some slow years after this one, though, huh?
Yeah. Well, at least, like, we have to give Nintendo the fact that they showed games for this year, you know, for 2012. Like, if you
right.
looked at the different conferences by other developers and the other manufacturers, like, it was all, like, coming 2013. And that got a little bit annoying. And, like, while we don't really know what's coming to Nintendo platforms in 2013, like,
Zelda, really... done. It's coming. And then it'll be delayed till 2014. What's your next question?
Yeah, exactly.
But yeah, like at least we've got something to play this year. That makes me pretty happy.
There's Super Mario Brothers U 2. There you go.
Bono is a secret character.
Well, Guillaume is exactly right. I mean, Nintendo has traditionally had a much more myopic focus on the games that they show at E3 versus other companies. They don't like to show things that they think will get delayed. They don't like to show things that will come out after the next E3. That's kind of their overriding principle. It has been for many years. We want to show you games that you'll be playing at home before the next E3. And a lot of companies don't do a very good job of that. So, yeah, I can respect that. Of course, games do get delayed, and that's, you know, you can say that's unexpected. But this year, I feel like the games that they showed, you know, are not only coming out before next E3, but probably coming out before the end of this calendar year. And that did set them apart. But at the same time, it does seem like their software planning is a bit lacking here. And I would also say that, you know, if they're publishing something like Project P100, you got to show that.
Yeah,
man.
I mean, show
that's a cool game. That is a Nintendo game. And, you know, Platinum's making it, but Nintendo's publishing it. You've got to showcase that. That is an original title. It's super cool.
So here's how we found out Platinum was making it. Oh, and they introduced the guy making it. Under his name, it said Platinum Games. That was how we found out this was a Platinum game on a fucking Spike TV special. I mean, Nintendo should have walked up on stage and said, "And we have a game coming to you from Platinum Games." That would have made that hardcore fan group really excited.
Of course.
I agree that the game deserved better and deserved to be showcased during their conference, but it could have been worse. Like, it could have been an Excitebot or... was Sin and Punishment shown at a E3 conference?
Yes.
It was. Okay. There was a demo, but it wasn't shown during the press conference, really. It might have been a very short video.
It was part of the reel.
Right.
Yeah.
But yeah, like something like Excitebots that come out like the first quarter, you know, like with no fanfare whatsoever.
Yeah, and you know, they've got this whole Nintendo Direct thing now, and they seem to think that this is a good way for them to reach out to their fans and announce games that might be coming out only a month or two later. You know, I don't know whether that's actually a successful way to do it yet, but that's kind of what they're going with. And so they feel like this gives them a way to, space out their announcements so that they don't have to rely so much on E3.
Well, and they don't have to rely so much on us.
Yeah. That's the other part of it. Yes.
They control the message. I mean, because we find out about the stuff with Nintendo Direct when you find out about it.
Yeah.
I mean, we're writing the news watching the same stream as you guys. We do get press kits, but they usually come over an hour after the broadcast finishes. I mean, we didn't even get a press kit for the Nintendo Direct that came before E3. There wasn't one. They just didn't send us anything.
Yeah.
We didn't get any Wii U fact sheets until after the Wii U press conference was over. I mean, it's, you know, Nintendo controls the message now. They've always liked to do it, and this is probably another tool in their toolkit to do it even more so.
Well, I think if you look at how much Nintendo spread out their announcements this year over, you know, several events over the course of the week, it tells me not that they had so much to announce that they couldn't fit it all into one press conference, but they thought the impact of some of these announcements was going to be greater than it actually was. You know, I think when they come out and they lead off their press conference with Pikmin 3, Nintendo feels like that's a really big deal, and it should be, but the way that they showed it at the press conference made it seem like just more of the same. You know, people are interested in Pikmin 3 because they're going on faith based on previous games in the series. But what Nintendo actually showed of Pikmin 3 at E3 was not actually very interesting.
I think they even went so far as to say, yeah, it's Pikmin, but it's in HD, which makes it much easier to zoom in on stuff.
Right.
Messaging
just let me run out and buy that.
Yeah, message fail. But that, I'm sure, is a very, very cool game, and I think Nintendo hasn't yet decided how they're going to market it or how they're going to, you know, make people understand what's cool about it. So, you know, and E3 is the time to sort that shit out, and they didn't do it. You know, I think Nintendo Land is a game that Nintendo thought is a really big deal, and again, the messaging, the way that was presented at the press conference was very confusing. I totally just zoned out at some point. And they're getting into the minutia of how you play this one specific game among 12.
So we talked about that on the home team show. I mean, we weren't there, so there's a certain amount of the sensory deprivation in a way. Like, we're not getting pounded by the ongoing affair of events. But to us, it was just like, move on. Go.
Yes.
Be somewhere else.
Let it go.
There was nothing to move on to. That's the problem. I also feel like the way the press conference was paced did make me kind of wonder if they had expected to show another game and it got pulled at the last minute. And so they had to kind of stretch a couple things out and they forgot to fix the part of the script where they complain about not having enough time because they had more than enough time based on the number of games that they actually showed.
They could have squeezed all three of those 3DS games in. I mean, it wouldn't have been a big deal.
Well, the way that they showed those 3DS games, I would have preferred that they just didn't show them at all.
Oh, yeah.
Because they did a much better job of showing at least those three the following evening at the separate event.
Right.
Yeah. You know, I just feel like, you know, I think that they expected the idea of having a new Mario game at launch to hit much, much harder
than it actually did.
And again, the problem is that this game is a very known quantity.
Sure.
And although, you know, as I said before, I am looking forward to it, and it's by far the most interesting of the four new Super Mario Brothers games that we've seen. It's just not that exciting.
No, I mean, it's,
Because it's not Mario Galaxy, it's not Mario 64, it's not Mario Sunshine. It's not something that you've never seen before. It's something that
it's not even 3D Land.
Yeah, exactly. So,
although it was quote a tech demo last year, we already saw a game that looked far along. We had all pretty much assumed this was going to be a game. So
yeah, I mean, I pretty much played this game a year
ago.
So, you know, whether it's really, really good or not, it's just not that exciting. You know, it's certainly not a surprise, and the whole thing was just totally lacking in surprise. And I think that's partly Nintendo's fault because they're doing all these Nintendo Direct events where they kind of meter out little pieces of information over time,
right.
And it makes it harder to build up enough pressure to really kind of,
right.
You know, have this giant revelation that's really, really exciting. But again, when you put so much of your resources and so much attention on a minigame collection like Nintendo Land, it's just going to be hard to engage the audience because although I'm sure Nintendo Land, you know, builds on the experience that they've had with other things and, I take them at their word that it'll be a deeper experience and more interesting than Wii Sports, for instance, or Wii Play. It's just not the kind of game that we want on Wii U. Like, we're already sick of that shit. Like, minigame collections were the downfall of Wii. It's part of the reason that the Wii sales are in a shithole right now, that they peaked so early and fell off so hard later on. And coming out and showing Nintendo Land at your press conference as your big finale is just not a very convincing way to introduce Wii U to your potential audience.
Yeah, if anything, that should have kicked it off.
Yeah.
And then had Pikmin 3 at the end.
Right.
You know, more of a blowout of Pikmin 3.
It's not like Batman was a better use of their time either.
No, that's horrible.
Oh, God.
Horrible.
We talked about that too. Basically, the Batman demo went on too long. It didn't really show what the Wii U gamepad was doing.
But you can press the screen to power up.
Fuck
when
that.
The meter fills up.
That was the James Cameron of Wii U presentations, was the Batman one.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, I mean, it's no surprise. It's like, okay, so so one of the things you do is, you know, you scan around to find stuff. Well, on the Wii U, you do that with the gamepad. Wow, what a surprise.
You can also do that in Zombie U, which is an original game that's an exclusive game that we've never seen before.
And Lego City Undercover as well.
I mean, the problem with Zombie U is they had almost overexposed that game before anybody ever played it. I mean, so Ubisoft showed it.
Yeah.
Nintendo showed it during the Nintendo Direct, although they didn't talk about it, which at the time, instead of doing some fucking absurdist skit that made me want to jab both my eyeballs out, they probably should have just talked about the damn game.
Yep.
I mean, I don't need to see some geriatric diaper-wearing guy in a Rascal scooter come on my screen and tell me about how I'm a terrible at playing video games.
Yeah, that
fucking segment could have gone somewhere else.
But didn't Ubisoft only show, like, a stylized trailer?
Right. They didn't actually show any gameplay or anything.
No, they didn't. I mean,
So, if anything, I think they could have spent even more time on Zombie U during Nintendo's conference.
I think they could have talked about it extensively, but I think they would have had to cut it from the Nintendo Direct, or at least repackage that segment. Yeah. Like to me, that water got poisoned almost after that segment aired. I'm like, that's a real game, and they just ruined it for me.
I think the other thing is, you know, I feel like in terms of the launch window and having a lot of franchises represented, and I think they're totally wrong, but I believe that Nintendo thinks having Nintendo Land, which has these kind of cutesy versions of all their different franchises, and having that ready for launch, maybe even packed in with the system, kind of gives people enough of a taste of having, let's say, Metroid on your Wii U, that you're okay waiting a little bit longer for that franchise to have a real proper introduction. And I just completely disagree. But I think that's that factors into their thinking, is, you know, why have entire games that can only serve two or three of the franchises when you can have this one minigame collection that gets you into all the different Nintendo franchises that you love. And it just doesn't work that way.
In retrospect, the way they should have shown Nintendo Land is they should have shown somebody playing the Donkey Kong game, which there's a video out there that we put up on our exclusive channel that's Neil trying to play the game, although being somewhat stymied by it. That's, you know, I learned more about that game than from watching that video than anything I read, anyone I watched play it as part of Nintendo events, any clip they showed, any video they released in their B-reel. Just watching a human being play that game, I understood it better. But it took 30 seconds. I didn't need 5 minutes of it. Show that game, show another game, show another one, and then present the Nintendo Land concept as sort of the unifying structure behind all that. Get us somewhat interested that there's gameplay here, not a Disneyland knockoff with a bunch of Wii's universe Mii's talking about. I mean, I don't need that. I know that Miiverse is a made up word, Iwata. You don't need to tell me. I don't need to have it demoed for me. Show me the gameplay and then tell me how it's packaged.
Beyond the conferences though, like, do we think that Nintendo is going to repeat this thing of only having a handful of 3DSs tethered to models and showing a game on the last day only? Because like, how can that possibly help their coverage?
No.
Like, I hope they learned the lesson here.
No,
I have to imagine that our site is one of the very few places you can find any amount of 3DS coverage from E3, because the games were so few and far between and so difficult to find and play.
On the last day of the show, I went directly for the new Super Mario Bros. 2 demo. There was absolutely no one around the two models that had like 4 units total to show it off. And I managed to play through the demo twice in a row, and I had no one like waiting after me in line. It was, everyone was just pathetic.
They announced that demo was going to appear on the last day at an event that 100 people got into, and could otherwise only be viewed over the internet. Which, by the way, no one at E3 is watching these things over the internet because they've got other things to do. So, no one knew that that game was going to appear. I mean, intentionally introducing a demo on the last day of the show has to be one of the dumbest ideas I've ever heard.
Yeah, I mean, they kind of did it in 2010 with that Zelda, that Ocarina of Time thing. They showed the Ocarina of Time tech demo at the round table. And then the last day of the show, it was on the show floor. You could actually go see it. But it was a tech demo. It wasn't a game coming out in 2 months. I mean, that game didn't come out for another almost year. I mean, it's a big deal.
That was basically just a video, right?
Yeah. And so it's funnily enough, Neil had it at the next E3, but it wasn't actually out for like a couple more days, I think.
Yeah.
So like, there was another E3 they could show it at. But I mean, for me, the 3DS was downplayed significantly because they wanted it to be the Wii U show. And I think to their that was a move to their detriment. I think
strange. I mean, I don't know why they wouldn't want to hype up the 3DS just to keep it going.
I was gonna say, not just for the sake of the 3DS and its current, you know, its current showdown with the competition it has, but also I think having a strong 3DS presence keeps a hype in your booth that allows the Wii U to catch eyes and gain more, you know, presence. That just having people in your booth doing things, seeing lots of experiences, keeps them in your booth longer and makes them more likely to engage everything you have. If you have a booth that I can get in and out of quickly and see a handful of things, that's it. I'm out. I never go to the Nintendo booth on day 2 of E3 if we have a day 1 appointment. I never do. I always spend day 2 in South Hall or wandering the rest of the hall that Nintendo's in. because I don't need to go back there. I've seen it. But if you give me a lot of games, like in 2010, when they had like 14 games and they had every franchise imaginable, including things like fucking Golden Sun, then yeah, I'm going to spend a lot of time in that booth. And I spent all of day one, a good portion of day two, and came back at the end of day three to see more of it. I mean, for me, Sengoku Basara. There's no way in hell I would have played that game, but because I spent so much time in their booth, I ended up wandering over there because there was no line.
Like, it was really not the time to not show 3DS games,
no.
Because no third parties were. Like, I got there and it made me feel bad. I thought, like, holy shit, the 3DS is dying. What's happening here? Like, it smelled like death, and I'm not talking about the unwashed nerds. Like, I felt like, wow, like, it's happening. Like, the Apple has killed Nintendo. Like, what's going on? And
yeah, but, you know, the sales in Japan would indicate otherwise.
Yeah, no, I know that, but, like, yeah. You had nothing to see.
Not everybody does, right?
The problem with the 3DS as it stands right now is that there still isn't significant Western development efforts. I mean, there just aren't. It's really troubling. I mean, you actually saw this towards the end of the Nintendo DS's life. Basically, it was licensed games and Japanese stuff. I mean, right now, I'm scanning my DS collection, and I have yet to hit going. Guitar Hero. The Guitar Hero game that Johnny sent me is the first game I hit on my collection that's not from a Japanese developer. And guess what? It's the last game on my collection. So, because it's fucking huge. But, I mean, like, that's not something they can allow to continue because the industry in Japan is not well. It's not as healthy as it used to be.
Right. And the third party stuff extends to Wii U as well. I mean, we touched upon the problems of showing Batman at the press conference, and that demo even on the floor wasn't very good. But beyond that, I mean, the problem is this is a miscalculation and a misunderstanding on Nintendo's part of which third party games are significant. I mean, Batman's Arkham City is one of the best games of 2011. You won't find a whole lot of argument about that, okay? But the problem is that game's already old now. By the time it actually comes out on Wii U, it will be over a year old. No one gives a fuck about that game a year after it comes out everywhere else. Nintendo has contemporary third-party release. They've got Assassin's Creed 3. They've got Darksiders 2. They've got Aliens Colonial Marines. They've got things that are coming out on Wii U at the same time as they're coming out on other systems. Those are the ones that you show. Show the games that aren't actually out yet. Those are the third party games that you show at your press conference and that you highlight in your booth. Not fucking Batman.
I am Batman.
I am the knight.
Just want to make sure you're aware.
I think that, you know, we kind of there were some comments last week about maybe pitting Ubisoft against EA or something like that. That sounds outlandish, but you look at the way that these companies had a presence at E3 and the way that they dealt with Wii U, and I start to wonder if there might actually be some of that going on. If Nintendo might be taking their buddy-buddy relationship with Ubisoft a little bit too far, because EA had nothing for Wii U at E3. Absolutely nothing. And that we know that they have games coming out on that system.
They have Madden coming out on the system.
Activision had fuck all for Nintendo. I went to Activision's booth and actively looked for Nintendo demos, and they had Skylanders. And they've, again, the biggest game of the year is from Activision, and it's coming out on Wii U, and not a word was spoken at this event. What is wrong with you people?
So, question, did Activision actually have a booth this year?
Yeah.
Because I know, okay, so they weren't doing their backroom stuff.
No, they had a booth.
Activision as a company is
They had a fucking
weird.
Loud booth.
Of course it's loud, it's Activision. I mean, to me, it just feels like, yeah, maybe Ubisoft... Maybe it's Nintendo's not trying. They're not engaging these companies and helping them say, hey, you know, why don't you show this game? Maybe it's because Ubisoft is willing to show these games. They'll take it on their own initiative to do it. And maybe the other publishers just don't like having to deal with getting enough press kits to demo the games from Nintendo, getting enough support from Nintendo to set up stuff for the demos. I mean, maybe it's a burden that Nintendo isn't willing to take upon themselves to make sure that Nintendo is ubiquitous.
Well, like, could it all...
I also think those third parties don't really make the kind, they don't prioritize Nintendo because the kind of games they make historically don't sell on Nintendo systems.
Yeah, like I was going to ask, like, do we think that perhaps Ubisoft is like the one major publisher that made the most money on off the Wii?
So they made the most money in the opening cycle of the Wii. Yes, they did. So Ubisoft basically their philosophy on a new console launch is to carpet bomb the shit out of it and hope two of the games make money.
Oh, they sold more games than Nintendo did at the Wii launch.
They did. They went crazy. I mean, but that's because they launched 9 games with Wii. I mean, it's and 2/3 of them were absolute dreck. But it didn't matter because only 2 of them really have to do well, and they made Red Steel. And Red Steel did well because it was the only game like it on Wii at the time. They put out Crysis, which did okay, but it was awful.
You mean Far Cry?
Far Cry. Yeah, but it was fuck awful.
Yeah.
And they put
Rabbids
out
was huge.
Rabbids, it was gigantic. It was a mini game. Yep, it was a mini game collection on Wii because WarioWare wasn't ready.
Yep,
I mean, and if WarioWare had been there, no, that game fucking dies on the vine. But it wasn't, so it did well. It made them lots of money. And if you go look at the performance of the sequels of those games on the Wii, you know, 2, 3, 4 years later, you'll see why Ubisoft carpet bombs the start of a console launch.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, I thought Ubisoft showed some really good games for Wii U, but they're not the only publisher supporting that system. And
no, and THQ seemed really involved according to the press conference, but as I understand it, they weren't really showing much off either, were they?
No, they didn't have the Wii U version of Darksiders 2, and they weren't really talking about it either. The third-party support is there, but it's just a mess right now. I mean, it doesn't make any sense the way Nintendo is packaging this stuff, and it seems like they're tying the hands of the companies a lot as to what they can say about the system and when they can announce their games, and that's not a good way to do it either. So
it feels an awful lot like every E3 I've been to, Nintendo basically sets themselves up as the one-stop shop for all their games. You go to their booth, you'll see everything. And I wonder if maybe that philosophy's come back to bite them in the butt. That by doing that, they almost sort of have to pick their children. Like, that, you know, I don't want to use a Sophie's Choice analogy, but they can't show everything.
Well, it really pushes the idea that Nintendo is its own industry, and you know, you right. can either care about it or not care about it, but it's not pervasive. And I think what Nintendo needs to have is games running on their systems all over E3, so you can't escape them. They're everywhere. That, to me, is really good. That shows that they're strong. That shows that they're being successful and that their device is pervasive and is part of the ongoing economy of video games. And when it's all isolated to this one tiny little location that's really crowded and has like 100 games in it, then it really does isolate them from everything else. When I go to Konami's booth and I say, I want to play your new game for Wii, and they say, it's only in Nintendo's booth. To me, that is not a good thing. That should be a game that Konami is promoting, not just Nintendo. Nintendo needs to promote it as well. And you find third-party games in Sony and Microsoft's booth, no problem. But those games are huge focuses of the publisher's own booths, and that's never the case with Nintendo, and it needs to be. These publishers need to take pride in the games that they make for Nintendo's consoles. They need to make it a big deal, and they just don't. And when you go and they have the multi-platform systems, a lot of times they have the game running on Xbox and PlayStation, but if you want to play the Nintendo version, that's only in Nintendo's booth. Again, it's just this utter lack of parity, and this is year after year. This is not just this year. This is every year at E3. This pisses me off.
It made sense with Wii because the Wii version looked worse. To an extent, it made sense for Nintendo to take it away from its visually superior competition so you couldn't do the quick eyeball compare. But it doesn't make sense now.
Nope.
It makes no sense with the Wii U. It just doesn't. And I suspect there's a certain amount of stuck in their way. I mean, we know as a company.
Well, yeah, I think also part of it is the fact that they really like to stress that the stuff that they make, you have to experience it. So they kind of want to be able to wall off the experience that they're selling from everything else. Yeah, they literally wall it off.
Yeah, I mean, if you ever watch a video tour of one of their booths, or if you go to E3, they will have walls that go straight to the ceiling and controlled entrance access points to their area. They are the only company that does it to that degree.
Yep.
They literally fortify their territory.
Well, Rockstar used to do that, but they don't even go to E3 anymore. You used to have a media badge to get into Rockstar's booth, period, on the floor.
Yeah, it was like some sort of VIP club. It was
very
weird.
Capcom does that to an extent. They'll wall off an area, and then you get let into the back room, and there's like nobody on any consoles. Like, well, I don't know if we can let you in. You only have a media level 2 badge. I'm like, there's nobody back there. And they're like, okay.
Well, enough bitching and moaning. It was not a great E3 for Nintendo, which is a separate issue as to whether Wii U will be successful or whether we're excited about it. So, totally separate thing. But yeah, in terms of evaluating E3, we're obviously frustrated, as many of you are as well, listening at home. But we're going to have to cut off listener mail after only 2 questions because we're so passionate about these issues. We will get to some of the ones that we couldn't read today on the next episode and more as well. So you can always send your emails to rfn@nintendoworldreport.com and we will get to more of them next time, I promise. So actually, before we go, we did have one more very quick email I want to read out because this is pretty cool for our listeners. So Pajamas writes, I happen to be in possession of an extra North American Club Nintendo code for the game Pokemon Rumble Blast. Could you guys do me a favor and give it away to some lucky listener? Maybe it will help get someone closer to platinum status for the year. Or you might actually want to play the game. I don't know. Anyway, thanks a lot. So Pajamas provided us a code, and it's just going to be first come, first serve. So you super listeners who listen to the show as soon as it's posted are probably going to have first dibs on this. The code is...
Or not, because I'm going to claim it for myself.
Oh, no, you're not. Ah. So this code you would enter into the eShop. If you want to download your own free copy of Pokemon Rumble Blast, maybe you'll be the first one. The code is 4, B as in boy, Z as in zoo, J as in J, Q, B, R, D, P, 8, Q, S, V, M.
M like mom.
M as in Mario, for crying out loud.
There you go. Hope you got lucky and got it. And thank you very much, Pajamas, for your generous gift there. I wanted to note that we are kind of doing some early planning for the next retroactive, and hopefully we'll have more to say about that next week. But I do want to remind everyone that we have an active sticky forum thread where you can leave your suggestions, and we do use that thread to come up with some ideas. So definitely appreciate those of you who have posted things there. So if there's games or even an entire category of games that you'd like us to consider for retroactive, you can post it there in the forums. It's under the podcast discussion section, along with the talkback for the episode show notes as well. I wanted to plug something that I think is very relevant for our listenership, and I didn't really get a chance to because this was published right before I left for E3, so I haven't really done a normal episode of RFN since I put this up, but there's a new episode of my other show, Discover Music Project, with Michael TYP Cole, and we did the music of Hip Tanaka, who, of course, is a video game composer responsible for very, very beloved game soundtracks such as Metroid, Kid Icarus, some music from the Mother and Earthbound series, and even Tetris for Game Boy. It's really, really iconic, fun stuff on there, and also some really crazy, obscure things as well. It's mostly 8-bit retro video game music. I think a lot of people would really enjoy it. And of course, TYP is a fantastic co-host for that kind of a show. So you can find that over at crosstalk.com or just search for Discover Music Project in iTunes. And finally, wanted to add that we do have the recently added RFN t-shirt design. So not just the one with our faces on it, but also some logo shirts that are kind of a lot simpler, some different shirt materials and designs that you can get. And of course, those promote and support the show financially as well. So I would really appreciate if you would go check those out, see if anything catches your fancy, and order one if it does. Those are can easily be found on our website over at nintendoworldreport.com. Just click on the banner. So thanks a lot for listening, everybody, and we will talk to you next week right here on Radio Free Nintendo.